Diversity.
Years have caused confusion.
I'll crash his board.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to a special office hours today where I'm joined by an august guest here, Dan from the Lotus Eaters. And as advertised, this is going to be the Trump tariff tussle. You can't see me, but I've got my boxing gloves on here, Dan. I'm ready to go. I've got a copy of Thomas Sowell's Basic Economics in one hand, and I've got a pair of brass knucks in the other ready to...
Well, I have the gloves off, and I'm certainly not going to be using economic basics.
All right. So if you're wondering, we have we somewhat disagree on what the effect of these Trump tariffs is going to be, even what Trump is trying to do and what's going to happen, etc. And you know, before I came on air, Dan, some really quite worrying things happened because I watched your coverage with Beau and was it Harry when you did the show on that?
Yeah.
And I listened to your analysis and I was, okay, yeah, Dan is making some good points. He kind of like sees the same things as me, but he's coming out with a different conclusion. So that's going to be interesting. But then it autoplayed, you know, when YouTube like autoplays.
Yep.
And Alistair Campbell and Rory Stewart came on a couple of weeks back. I made I made a video called "Why I Hate Rory Stewart." If you remember,
I do.
And the worst of all things happened is that, well, I was kind of away from my desk, so it kind of played. So I was basically just listening to these two, and I actually started agreeing with Rory Stewart.
So
what was being said.
You're in an interesting situation because you are now agreeing with Rory Stewart, who's the other one, the war guy, Ben Shapiro, Boomers.
Jeffrey Sachs.
Yep.
Alistair Campbell and various other people, Richard Wolff.
Yep.
And the reason I'm agreeing with them is because, economics is still economics. It doesn't really matter who's saying it or doing it. And we'll go into the specifics soon. I'm just going to allow people to trickle in here. Before we get going, Dan, I just like to say I've always loved my fans here. It's great. All of you fans here, I do this for you. If it just wasn't for scumbags like Dan Tubbs, who doesn't appreciate the audience, he's always trash-talking you behind the scenes. I'm always sticking up for the little people. Dan, any messages for the crowd before we get going?
Well, no, I love my audience as well. It's just some of the utards that irritate me. But I'm not talking about all of you. Just some of you.
I will also. It's great to be back here in sunny Guildford. Before we get going, I do have a sale on at the moment. A spring sale. It's been gorgeous weather, actually. Do you know what happened the other day, Dan? I was in the car and little AAA was like, "Oh, Daddy, it's the moon." I was like, "What? Shut up. It's lunchtime. The moon is not out." And sure enough, the moon was there in the sky. So I stopped and I took a picture and I just said, "Oh, I've never seen the moon at 1:30 p.m. before." That tweet, Dan, got a million views on Twitter. And I only noticed like a day later, I was like, what the hell's going on here? Because they're only at like 300 likes. And I reached the front page of the internet, the front page of Twitter. And if you go on that tweet, it's literally just hundreds, thousands of people from all around the world dunking on me saying, what is this guy like? He's never been outside before. Oh, don't you even know that the moon comes out? Oh, look at Britain. They never have a sunny day. Like people in Spanish and like German, like every language you can imagine.
On the plus side, with a tweet like that, you've got the mortgage paid for this month.
The missus found it absolutely hilarious and then like sided with the crowd. And she was like, yeah, they're right, you know. Haven't you ever been out before? The moon's always out. I was like, what's going on here? I mean, I've seen it at like 4 or 5 p.m. Never seen it at lunchtime before. It's just that it was a very, very clear day. So, you know, usually you don't see the moon at lunchtime.
I can't remember if I haven't. It's not the sort of thing I'd mentally make a note of, to be honest.
Yeah. But if you want to laugh, go through the quote tweets of that, because you'll see, like, literally me being dogpiled by the entire world. Like, oh, look at modern procrastinated man out of touch with nature. And it's just every single dunk imaginable, you know. I have a spring sale on, 25% off, promo code Mandy. I'm going to have to subject you to it. But before I play it, Dan, anything you want to promote, sir?
Brokenomics, I guess. I work at the Lotus Eaters. We do a daily podcast. I'll be on tomorrow, and I might come back to this tariff thing because, you know, it won't go away. It's been in the news cycle for 2 weeks, which is basically an eternity these days. That's a very enduring news story. And I've got a Brokenomics coming out today, which I recorded last week, on the basics of tariffs. And I might even do a second one where I go a bit deeper into the macro side of things, which we're probably going to get into here today.
Great. Yeah, I should mention Islander Magazine is something I've contributed to every single time. I don't know if that's on sale at the minute or anyone's coming out or whatever.
But it sold out. We only get a very limited supply of them because we want them to become collectibles. In fact, I've seen them appear on eBay for $200.
Last one was gorgeous, I have to say. If you have a chat with Rory. If you see Rory around the office, tell him that cover, last cover, was excellent. Anyway, promo code Mandy, ladies and gentlemen. Get ready for some dark synth Peter Mandelson. And when we come back, we're going to do the Trump tariff tussle.
Country in which I have spent so much of my adult life and admire so much.
Promo code Mandy. 25% off all courses. Come on down. Academic Agency. Every single course. 25% off. Promo code Mandy.
Country in which I have spent so much of my adult life and admire so much.
Great. Foundations of Economics, people. I reckon a lot of people need that course because I'm seeing a lot of really silly things being said, like really kind of economics 101 stuff. Dan, I'm getting a lot of people saying there's an echo. So I don't know if it's possible to, like, I don't know if it's why that's coming through, but when you talk, there's an echo. So I'm just, so I don't know how we want to do this, Dan, because I wrote 8 points that I've got. You had 8 counterpoints. But why don't we just set up the basic positions here? I think probably worth me going through my points, and then I think it follows that your counter then sums up what your position is as well.
That's fine. If the echo is absolutely insufferable, I'll have to go and get my man who knows about the buttons to come and have a look.
Okay.
So chat, keep us advised if it's really bad or if it's just, you know, normal background whinging.
All right. So in terms of my points here, I've got 8 points. No, they're Dan's points. I've got 8 points here, which I'll go into. So first thing is, one of my problems, Dan, is that MAGA supporters, people who support Donald Trump, don't actually agree on why this is being done in the first place. Half of the people are saying that it's being done for economic nationalist reasons, to bring back manufacturing, yada, 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 or to destroy globalism. And the other half of people, like Scott Greer and various other kind of Trump talking heads, basically, have said, actually, no, it's a negotiation strategy to get all of the other countries to drop their tariffs, right? Actually resulting in freer trade rather than this kind of economic nationalist platform that other people are talking about. To me, those two positions are fundamentally contradictory. They're at odds, right? Because, you know, if it's actually going to result in freer trade, then all of this other stuff we're talking about is moot, right? So point one is, if it's a negotiation strategy, if Scott Creer is right, or if all those other people are right, then this is just another slimy GOP play to trick the rubes yet again, okay? And you can have your fell for it again badge, okay? That's point one. Second point is...
Well, shall I address point one, or do you want me to go...
Yeah, let's do it like this. Let's do it like that. It'll be fun. Let's go one. Okay.
I'm not sure they are mutually exclusive, because, I mean, it's not like we're talking about there is a single trade good, and therefore it has to be one or the other. You have multiple different fronts, and what this is really about is a strategic realignment. And there are certain industries, defence and pharmaceuticals, semiconductors being the key ones, that you do want to bring back. Things like coffee and trainers are, you know, by the by. I mean, whatever, they can either cost a little bit more, or you can do a deal on them, or the case of Madagascar, which is probably the best example. Madagascar just produces vanilla. It doesn't buy much from the US because they're subsistence farmers. They buy a little bit of machinery and chemicals from the US. You know, what's the point of having whatever it was, 74% tariffs on Madagascar? I can well see those being negotiated down. But the key thing is, I mean, it is trying to achieve a number of things, which we'll get to when we come to my points. But on the aspect of, is it a realignment or is it negotiation? Well, it's going to be a realignment where it matters, and it's going to be a renegotiation where, frankly, it doesn't.
All right. So I was muted, by the way, and people are still talking about an echo. But anyway, second point is, if Trump is serious about reindustrialization, right, if it is actually a bid to bring back the factories, bring back manufacturing, the tariffs, right, would be strategic and targeted, like you were just talking about, not a back of the fag, right, back of the fag packet blanket calculation, which doesn't even represent tariffs, right? I mean, of all of the two-bit carny things I've ever seen, right, the actual formula was trade deficit, okay, trade deficit divided by total imports times 100 divided by 2, right? I mean... this is literally the US government of America saying, actually it's too difficult. It's actually too complicated to figure out what tariffs are being put on us. We've only got all of that data right in front of us. Instead, what we're going to do is just do this arbitrary, crude, simplistic calculation that results in, you know, ridiculous numbers, like putting a 90% tariff on Vietnam. You know, it's just like, it's not strategic. That is the opposite of strategic. That is like,
okay,
there are some numbers we've just made up.
So, 2 points. First of all, the crucial point is, my man who does the buttons is back and pressing buttons. So hopefully the echo thing will get sorted out, because he knows about these sort of things. Second thing, I think it's the very definition of strategic, because on one hand, the trade imbalance is the thing that they're looking to address. And what they're effectively saying is, look, this is based, it's derivative from the trade imbalance. And they're putting it out to the trade partner, you know, find a way to get this down. How you do that is up to you. If it's a strategically important good, we might opt it out of these tariffs. If it's a trade line of which we are not particularly interested in, we don't see that there's trade lines going back, then fine, we can do some negotiations. Or there can be other negotiations. But essentially, it's putting the onus on each individual country to come up with something that works in their particular circumstances. Now, it feels like what you're suggesting is that the US government should have gone through and rigorously worked out in each and every case what the end position of the negotiation should have been, where they should have got to. Well, you can still get to that from here. But if you started at that position, you would have denied yourself the negotiation process that we're about to go through. So over 70 countries at this point have reached out to America and said, look, we're looking to do a deal. If you had started at the end point, you would have denied yourself that, and you would only end up with the tariff relationship outcome at the end of it. You would have denied yourself the ability to take anything else into consideration during that negotiation process. So you're fundamentally stronger by going via the negotiation process.
Yeah, but I mean, it's led to absurd situations, like tiny little African countries that nobody even heard of, which, you know, happen to have, you know, some tiny, you know, the tiny amount they actually do export you know, on paper looks like a very big number. So they've been hit with massive tariffs. I mean, I heard in one place, America's actually put a tariff regime on an island which is inhabited by penguins, Dan, right? This is, to me, that is not the definition of strategic. That is just lazy, isn't it? It's literally just lazy to say, oh, right, we're going to put a blanket. We're not going to actually going to look at what each of these countries is doing. We're going to just haphazardly apply it, blanket across the board, see what happens.
Yeah, but the big the trade imbalance is the thing that they want to address. So if you start from the position of where there is a trade imbalance, we want to address it, you're putting the onus on them to find a solution around it and quite possibly have negotiations of how you mitigate these things. So where would you start from? If you're going to do these, if you're not starting from the big picture of the trade imbalance is the thing we want to address in most cases, and actually I think the broader view is actually strategic rather than this tactical stuff. If you're not going to start there, where do you start?
Well, I mean, I don't even think that a trade imbalance in the first place is the thing to focus on, as I'll get onto. I mean, maybe I should get some of my later points, but yeah. I mean, you know.
Well, I agree the trade imbalance is not the primary issue here, but
let's just talk about Thomas Sowell, Basic Economics, right? Yeah. There's a whole section in International Trade on there, and he's got a couple of pages devoted to the fact that trade deficit, because the word deficit sounds bad, people think it's bad, right? But that's not actually, all it means is you have given money in exchange for goods, right? They get money, you get goods in exchange. I have a trade deficit with the bloke I bought my lunch from, for example, okay? It's not necessarily bad, it just means you have bought stuff. So essentially what you're saying is, it is bad when you buy stuff, when you buy more than you sell, right? That is a bad thing. And what Thomas Sowell says is that, like, listen, you can't base policy on the fact that you don't like the sound of a word, right? I mean, the inverse of this, which Trump, by the way, has also done in his first administration, is when Sowell talks about, the dollar is weak or the dollar is strong, right? Well, strong sounds good and weak sounds bad. During his first administration, Trump was boasting about how strong the dollar is because he likes the sound of the word strong, right? I mean, I honestly don't think that we're dealing with, like, you know, super genius 4D chess. I genuinely think that Trump, since the 1980s, just has these kind of, you know, never picked up an economics textbook type view that, oh, weak sounds bad, I want the dollar to be strong. Deficit sounds bad, I want there to be a surplus.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly true that rich countries can import from poor countries, and this is, you know, Ricardian 101 global wage arbitrage. But what I would say is, don't confuse the ability to run trade deficits with the wisdom of doing so. And I get that the imperial logic, you know, shields them from the effects of that, but only to a point. And it does not shield them from the long-term consequences of that and the inefficiencies that can arise as a result of it. So, I mean, yes, on an individual country level, it doesn't particularly matter if you're running a deficit against, I don't know, Vietnam, as long as you're running a surplus against Cambodia. But the US is running a across the board deficit. You know, its overall deficit is significant. And how are you going to fund that? Well, the only way that you're going to fund that is by selling down assets, which is exactly what is happening. So the wisdom of this long term, especially when you're supporting it effectively through money printing, I think the long-term effects of this are actually quite harmful, even if one particular country-to-country trade may not matter that much.
Why don't we get to these next two points then, because they're about this. First thing is, I think Americans have had a good thing going, right? And one of the things that annoys me is the dishonest framing of Trump's arguments here, okay? They have been getting goods, like stuff, whether it's iPhones or slop, whatever the thing is, okay? They've been getting that stuff practically for free in exchange for worthless dollars, monopoly money, basically. The framing that other countries are, quote unquote, taking advantage of them is dishonest, sick, and wrong, okay? The total size of the US debt is a measure of its imperial power. The total size of its imports is a measure of its purchasing power. The goods it receives are like all of the other countries of the world that we're talking about, are peasants sending tribute to a fat king. Okay. Besides all of that, most of the trade deficits are because the USA is rich, i.e. it has a lot of money, and those countries importing, for example, Vietnam, I'm using Vietnam because that had a 90% tariff slapped on it, are poor, right? Even Germany, relative to the USA, is poor, okay? We think of Germany, the world's third biggest economy, is rich, but actually compared to the $27 trillion US economy, it's poor. So focusing on the trading imbalance between the USA and Vietnam is a waste of time because Vietnam has practically no purchasing power whatsoever. You're essentially asking for the fat king to make things for peasants to buy, okay? If you're focusing on fixing the trade imbalance between Vietnam and USA, you're saying, what?
I have lost you, AA. I don't know if you can still hear me.
Can you hear me now, Dan? Sorry.
I can hear you now.
Sorry. I knocked my mic.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is, if you're focusing on the trade imbalance, right, between USA and Vietnam, you're talking about, like, what can a country with $27 trillion, okay, of an economy, that's the USA, what can that make that people in a country which has total economy 450 billion or 400 billion, that's the total size of the Vietnamese economy, right?
You've gone super echoey to me. I don't know if that's on my side or your side. If you notch your mic again or something.
I don't know.
You're back to normal. Okay, so I get the points that you're raising about Vietnam, and I totally get why that's a big problem for the president of Vietnam and of Nike, but it's less clear to me why that should be a primary consideration for President Trump.
Well, the point is, Dan, is that focusing on the trade imbalance between those two things, what can America produce that people in Vietnam are going to be able to afford to buy? The average worker in Vietnam has no money. So you can make stuff in America all day long, but you're not going to be able to flog it to the Vietnamese. That's why the factories are in Vietnam.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's why when we come to my point, you see, I really pivot to the strategic layer of this stuff because I just don't think it is about Vietnam. It's about this whole thing is primarily about China. It's China, the whole thing. The issue you got with the country
Sorry. If China's the whole thing, then why has Trump slapped tariffs on all of its European trading partners? Why has he slapped tariffs on its immediate neighbors? Why has he slapped tariffs on every single on the Penguin Island? You know?
So the reason is because otherwise he is trying to achieve a number of things. What this is effectively is about is a reordering, and that reordering is driven primarily by China. The need to do it is from China, but it still needs to be a global reordering, so it can't be applied to China alone. Very specifically in the case of Vietnam, is if you put high tariffs on China and you don't put it on anywhere else, they will just redirect everything through countries like Vietnam. The reason why Vietnam has such a large trade imbalance with the US at the moment as it is because on the previous round of tariffs and the focus on China, what they did is they just relocated all the textiles from southern China into Vietnam. And the growth in textiles in Vietnam has driven this big trade imbalance. Now, what Trump needs to do is he needs to get this global reorganization, which we'll come to when we get onto my points a little bit later. But he's got to also cover the countries of which it is going to go via. The other thing that you raised about Europe is he is going to need to move in this new framework. He is going to need to move people into basically good lists and bad lists. Now, this is something that the US has done before, or they've dropped it. They had at one time, I think they called them buckets. I can't remember whose conception this was, but the green bucket, the yellow bucket, and the red bucket. The green bucket was allies. The yellow bucket was going to be independent countries, which at the time was things like India. And then the red list would have been the Soviet Union. It's effectively a return to that, but it's starting from a position of, we're just going to apply this at the strategic problem of trade imbalances. And then we're going to enter into a negotiation process. And what will almost certainly happen is that the people then start getting siloed into those buckets. Now, does that mean that Vietnam can come down? Yes, it probably can. It's never going to come down that low because it's so close to China that it can be used to simply redirect goods from China via Vietnam. That's also the justification for the Penguin thing, that you know somebody could set up a pontoon there and redirect stuff there. Now, I don't know whether that's true or not, but the point is that the Vietnam is not the primary consideration here. The Penguin Islands certainly isn't the consideration here.
All right. Well, let's carry on going through these points. So the next thing is that a lot of people I've been arguing with, especially red hat wearers, MAGA supporters, and so on, have been arguing that the US could become self-sufficient. That the whole point of this is to move manufacturing back to the USA. Okay, my argument is simply that this is fallacious. Right, the idea that America could become self-sufficient, right, it clearly isn't true, because if it could be, it would already be self-sufficient. If the USA could meet its own demand, it wouldn't have to import $3.38 trillion of goods every year. Even allowing for things like coffee, right, which the US cannot make, Trump tariff coffee too, by the way, clown. But anyway, let's continue. It will be practically impossible to reproduce the supply chain that manufactures those $3.38 trillion worth of goods at a price point of $3.38 trillion, right? That the whole reason that supply chain exists in the way that it does is that it gets the price point of the end of the consumer product down. The structure of production, including all of the intermediary goods, many of which are made by China, by the way, probably requires more workers than there are people in the USA, period. I mean, this is just standard division of labor stuff, right? The division of labor for all of the products in the entire structure of production, right? We're talking about millions of people there that went into making, you know, when you consider the factory that make the made the screws and the factory that made the rubber and the factory that made this. And, all right, that's a lot of people. You're not going to be able to reproduce that entire supply chain within America, especially given, and I might as well say the next 2 points here because they're related, the costs of operating in America, okay? So there are two fallouts of this. One is the underlying issue as to why companies like Nike outsourced in the first place. This is this point here, right? So besides all of the things I've said, the fundamental issue is not about trade policy, okay? It's about the combination of labor costs and freedom of capital. That is, the American government at some point in its history allowed massive corporations like Nike or Apple or whoever to set up factories in Vietnam. Why did the Nike set up the factories in Vietnam in the first place? It's because a US worker costs $1,000 a week. Okay, that's the median wage for a worker in America, versus in Vietnam, it costs about $90 a week. There's no way around this. Like, the labor costs are why you have factories in Vietnam, factories in China, factories in all these different places. And simply saying, oh, I'm going to stick tariffs on you and we're going to rectify this trade, you know, we want to rectify this trade imbalance, is not going to create a magic wand situation where wages in America go down to wages in Vietnam. So there's still a good reason for the factory to exist in third world places. And the final point, Dan, is this one here, which is the political fallout. Right, Trump has got a small window in which he is able to act here. Okay, people used to having lots of stuff for practically nothing are not going to like being poorer. Okay, and they will be poorer. Trump, whatever you want to say about Trump, he's not Julius Evola. Okay, Julius Evola was a spiritual critic of modernity, of capitalism, of materialism, and so on and so forth. Okay, what Trump did is he promised the American public a golden age. When people see that they're not going to get a golden age, they're going to go back to the Dems, they're going to go back to liberalism, they're going to start listening to Gary Economics or whoever, okay? And the right wing around the world will be totally discredited. That's the political fallout. So you're going to get people who are poorer. It's not going to bring the jobs back. And and it's going to discredit populists, economic populism, people who supported Trump, people who were for this, because the public will just see, oh, if you go that way, all it's going to do is make me, you know, poorer, and I still don't have a job. So, and then the final point is historical, but on that, Dan, before you come back on it, I do have this clip from Jeffrey Sachs where he lays out all of this in kind of a neat 5-minute package. Okay, I think it's worth me playing this to truly outline the consequences of what I've just said there. If you want to interject, you can just say pause and I can pause it and you can come in. Yeah, but I think it's worth listening to Sachs here, because the promises that have been made on the back of essentially trade policy to me are fantastical. But let's see what Sachs says, who's a professor of economics at wherever he is, Stanford or Yale or whatever.
Balance has deeper roots than trade policy. Trade policy doesn't end the imbalance. Okay, let's wipe that slate clean. That was the motivation given. That was the argument. The argument is we're being ripped off. We will therefore stop the ripoffs by imposing tariffs. And that will end the ripoffs defined as a trade imbalance, which isn't a ripoff to begin with. Now, there are other arguments that are given, of course. Another argument is this will raise the living standards of Americans, and notably of industrial workers. This too is fundamentally false, because U.S. workers actually have living standards in part because they can buy goods from abroad that are relatively inexpensive. You raise the price of those goods several thousand dollars, really raising living standards of American workers. The answer is, in general, certainly not. Well, what about the wages of the workers just in the industrial sector, where the protection will be greatest? Will you raise those wages? Probably not. Even there, even in the limited part of the economy, understanding that the industrial employment is only around 10% of the U.S. labor force. Most people work in the service economy, and their incomes are really going to go down in real terms because of the inflation on imported goods. But what about the protected industrial sector? Surprisingly, even there, the wages are likely to go down in real terms, because production in the United States is actually complementary to production abroad. In other words, certain parts of the production process take place in Mexico, or take place in China, or take place in Vietnam, or take place in Canada. And then those intermediate products are imported to the United States and turned into finished goods. It's plain that this has hollowed out the U.S. industrial sector. Not quite so. What it has done is put the lower skilled, lower wage work abroad so that Americans can earn more in the higher productivity parts of the value chain. In other words, what is being produced in Mexico or in China or in Vietnam is not the same thing that's happening in the United States. And what's happening in the United States is higher end production, more skilled work, typically workers with the much more educational attainment. The labor intensive, low productivity work is being done elsewhere. That is being brought into the United States at an intermediate stage. Now, suppose you say, no, no, we're not going to do that anymore. Americans have to do all of it. That's not going to raise their living standards. That's going to push workers into the labor-intensive, low-skilled sectors in this value chain. That lowers living standards. It doesn't raise it. It also makes American industry completely uncompetitive with any other country that uses an international value chain. Take another country that does the low-cost production work in low-cost places, finishes the skilled work in skilled places, that's going to be a lower production cost than what the United States is going to end up with, taking advantage of the global division of labor. So in the end, living standards in the U.S. will fall even in the industrial sector. In other words, Trump is breaking things. He is...
Yeah,
you get the idea, Dan.
I get the idea. Yes. It's classic boomer, let them eat flat screens kind of approach. The assumption that because it's working for the top 10% of the population who are doing the as he calls it, the higher skilled design type jobs that we can sort of generally...
Hold on, Dan. No, that's not what he said. What he said was those people who are working in factories right now, that 10% of workers in US manufacturing, if you have a look at the actual jobs they do, okay, in a highly automated international supply chain, they are near the top of that supply chain, and all of the lower skilled work is done. Like, I'll give you an example, right? For all of my life, or most of my life, my dad worked in a factory for Ford, okay, which was located in Bridgend. What did they actually do in that factory? Okay, and those jobs that were in that Bridgend plant, which is no longer there, by the way, it's been sold off to the Chinese, incidentally. But what that plant did is it took all the parts from all of the other parts of the supply chain, from cheaper places, from Eastern Europe, from some parts from Germany, some parts from elsewhere. It put together the engine. Right, they produced engines in that Ford plant. Then the engine that they put together was sent to Germany, and the engine was then put into the cars, and a made in Germany stamp was put on it. That is how that supply chain worked. Now, what that meant was is that those people who worked in that Ford plant, or that those people right at the end of the supply chain in Germany, had quite high wages, but the lower jobs like making the screws and all the little plastic parts and stuff, so on, lower down, the sort of job done by the guy in this meme here was being done in some third world place that we don't need to think about.
So I do get all of that, but it's based on a misconception of what this is trying to achieve. It's not trying to achieve full autarky. It's not trying to be a complete economic isolationist. What it's trying to do is achieve resilience in key sectors and address the broader imbalance. And actually, there's a layer above that, which is some of the arguments that I'm going to be coming on to into a minute. But they are not trying to achieve full independence with this. So you can still have those supply chains. The focus has been very much on elements of strategic importance. Like I mentioned, it's the military supply chain. It's pharmaceuticals. It's semiconductors. It's things like that. Also, your points about, didn't you talk about political realism at one stage, about having their sort of, costs go up slightly? If we go by the book, when you apply a tariff, 4% of it goes to the producer, 4% is absorbed through the currency, through adjustments in the currency, and about 2% ends up on the consumer. And yes, a bit more is going to land on the consumer as a result of this, especially in areas that are not strategically important, which is going to be a large amount of their consumption. So yes, your price of the coffee might go up a little bit, and your price of your trainers might go up a little bit. But, What is the alternative? Because we cannot just assume that the US is at a steady state equilibrium. And again, I'll come onto that more when we come onto my points, that the current situation is untenable. There does need to be a readjustment. And I mean, more broadly to, some of the people on the right making this argument, I observe that they are often the same people who have spent the last 10 years complaining about line go up politicians. And this is a deviation from line go up. This is not trying to maximize the lowest possible price point in your Nike store or your coffee row. It's trying to achieve something more strategic than that. So the moment we get a break from line go up politician, you know, you've got to accept that there will, yes, there will be some sacrifice to this, but the alternative, doing nothing and assuming that the equilibrium is going to be maintained, that I think is a fallacy and that will not hold up.
But, you know, currently a lot of those intermediary goods that you were talking about, Dan, in the supply chain, those critical ones are produced by China.
Which
Trump has just slapped a massive tariff on China. They've retaliated by slapping a massive tariff back. All that's going to do is increase the cost of the entire supply chain around the world, making all goods more expensive for everybody.
So two key points here, and this is certainly something that Jeffrey Sachs is falling into the trap of. Don't judge this stuff by the headlines. There are going to be hyperbolic headlines, and when it comes to Trump and Xi, they're going to be coming out with their talking points, and they've all got to look like a strong man. There is more alignment on the back end of this than you might appreciate in terms of some of the currency things that I'll be coming on to talk about. Secondly, on the point of, oh, it's just going to push up the cost of stuff that you need from China. So let's talk about some of those things that you need from China. China dominates the majority of key medications that are used in America. So all sorts of heart medications, diabetes medication. And if you're saying, oh, well, it's just going to push up the cost. Well, that is the problem. Do you want to be in a situation where China can decide to turn off your ability to import heart medication or diabetes medication and a whole slew of other things? No, you need to get that relocated back into the US. You know, this was something that became extremely obvious during the COVID period. In fact, during the COVID period, there was a, I forget his name because it's completely unpronounceable, but a senior, well-regarded Chinese politician was just saying, let's just cut off the US from a whole bunch of the medications that it needs. That is clearly a problem, and it's clearly why that needs to come back on. Another data point, 2018, the Pentagon commissioned a study in which they found that the US military would be rendered ineffective at hundreds of different points along its supply chain if it were ever cut off by China. Now, given that the main geopolitical rival is China, you cannot put yourself in a situation where, if you ever go to war with your main geopolitical rival, that they can basically shut down your military by not supplying it. So evidently, things like pharmaceuticals and military components or munitions, whatever it is, that clearly needs to come back to the US. So yes, it's going to push up the cost in the very short term. Longer term, what it will do is those key sectors of things being targeted will move to the US, and that's a good thing.
But so to sum up, people are going to be poorer. They are going to be worse off, but it's worth it to not be relying on China.
They are going to be poor compared to what? Because
compared to what they've been used to. Because they see I've seen a lot of people, right, say, oh, well, we don't need Land Rovers. Oh, we don't need Nintendo Switches. Oh, we don't need cheap tap from Amazon. But again, economics 101, these things are being sold in huge quantities because people want them.
But we are
what I'm saying is, the reality is that at the moment, they're used to having this stuff on tap. And you want to turn the taps off. Okay, now you could say, well, it's politically worth it. It's strategically worth it. It is for the good of the military industrial complex, whatever, it's worth it. What I'm saying is, just admit that it is actually going to make people poorer, and that's going to take some readjustment, because now the American public are going to have a lower living standard than they're used to, because they're not going to have all the mod cons on tap. You know, one of our dickhead politicians came out the other day and said, look, the era of a cheap TV is over. Forget about it. Globalism's done. You know, we're going to go, but it's going to go, basically, you're going to be worse off. You're going to be poorer. This system, we're dismantling it. So you're going to own nothing and you're going to be happy.
So the big assumption here is that those taps were going to remain on forever if these tariffs weren't done. We are at the point where very soon there is going to have to be a realignment one way or the other. Now, it is easy to think, because if you judge it on living memory, that the current set of conditions are perennial, that the exorbitant privilege is just an immutable law of physics and it's always going to be there. it is not. Now, if you look back over a longer period, a period longer than a single human lifespan, reorderings in the global system do occur, and they tend to occur every sort of 80 to 100 years. So just about within the reach of a human lifespan, but only once. And what the problem that you've got with the sort of boomer crowd like Jeffrey Sachs is they're looking back over their lifetime and they're seeing this long period of stability. And they're thinking, okay, well, this is just going to last for, you know, until my grandchildren are my age. It is not going to last until that time. So the dangerous assumption is that this was an option and that those taps were going to stay on forever. So yes, compared to the assumption that nothing was ever going to change, yes, the cost of your Nintendo Switch is going to go up a bit, but it was necessary as a readjustment.
But, you know, Jeffrey Sachs is probably old enough to remember the 70s. I can't remember the 70s when he read about it, right? But what happened in the 70s? What happened in the 60s and the 70s in this country? The British government did all sorts of protections, did all sorts of Keynesian policies, the post-war consensus, they called it, to try to keep British manufacturing going through... And what actually was the result of that? Okay, I remember watching Milton Friedman videos where he's in 1980 going around a British steel plant saying, look, the British government is subsidizing this steel factory. All of these people are in this factory making steel, and it's just not going to be, it's going to be sold at a loss, or basically nobody wants it.
Okay? Well,
what Jeffrey Sachs was saying was, if you can bring manufacturing back, but who you're not competitive anymore. That's the whole reason why manufacturing moved to those places, is because in the West, you were no longer competitive to run the factory in Sheffield or to run the factory in Detroit. That's why the deindustrialization happened in the first place. And there was an attempt to protect all those industries in the 60s and 70s, and it didn't work. That was Thatcher and Reagan was all about that. It didn't work. And that, what you're saying is, let's go back to that so we can once again stockpile rusting steel that nobody wants because it's too expensive. Because we can't get our steel to a price point that's competitive with China.
No, that's not my point. The issues with the 1970s were not a product of the policy attempted at the time. That, you know, you've got to go back another 30 years to see why Britain was in the state that it was in the 70s. The 70s were just catching up with the reality of it. And the global reorganizations that I'm talking about similarly happened at a you know, sort of 30-year period earlier to that. You know, these things are infrequent when measured in lifespans, but they do come around fairly persistently every sort of 80 to 100 years. And we're at the point now where we are looking at another one of those coming up. What was your second point on...
Well, I can just read my last point, Dan, if you want, which is the final one, because we've talked about historical situations here. A lot of people have said, well, look at what America did in the 19th century. Look at what it did in 1870. Look at what it did in 1910. Look at what it did in 1950 and so on. Okay. All of these arguments, I think, are fallacious again, because the circumstances were so different. In the late 19th century, when there was that tariff regime, during that period, incidentally, the USA ran a trade deficit for most of the 19th century. It finally managed to become an export economy in the late 19th century. Basically, during the early part, it was teching up, right? It was ramping up in much the same way that the so-called tiger economies were doing in our lifetimes, like South Korea or those other Southeast Asian nations. They also, you know, were doing that, you know, because they were, what do they call them, infant industries. So they had to have robust tariffs in place. Otherwise, they would have been steamrolled by the European industrial powers at that time. Okay. During that time, it was an emerging power. Okay. It essentially acted as the Southeast Asia for the European imperial powers. During the whole period of the British Empire, America was basically the number one provider of grain. Do you remember the repeal of the Corn Laws?
Yeah.
Well, who stepped in to sell the grain? You know, that was your, the American grain, American wheat, American cotton, corn, whatever was coming in over that time. In the late 19th century, they were able to switch over to manufacturers, and they started getting competitive in that time. Then the World Wars happened, which meant that Europe was a captive market for America to sell its stuff into, right? In the 1930s, and then especially in the 1950s, there was a captive export market because Europe was in flames. It had two world wars, so there was a massive rebuilding process. And America, not just Marshall Aid, but through its export economy, was able to sell lots of stuff.
So I get all of that, but what's the core argument here?
The core argument is that you cannot base policy today based on stuff that they were doing in the 50s or in the 1870s, because it's a broken wind. It's a broken window fallacy. You're basically saying, we need to do stuff in a situation where, most of the developed world had suffered a world war, right? I mean, you can't recreate that, and it only lasted up until about 1975.
Okay, but I'm not making that argument. I'm not aware of anyone in the administration.
I'm saying I faced that argument from various MAGA people. So that's one that I put in there because Americans love to point to like historical precedent or, Alexander Hamilton and all this sort of stuff. I mean, Alexander Hamilton had to put in robust tariffs and protections in place because if he hadn't, the British, who he just defeated in a revolution, would have just steamrolled in and taken over their industry in space of 5 years. This is a very different circumstance. The circumstance right now is America is the number one economy in the world, right? And it has the greatest purchasing power in the world, right? So the situation...
But are you operating under the assumption that position is unassailable and will continue indefinitely?
I'm operating on the assumption that, given that it is true right now, okay, given that it is true that America has the most amount of money in the world, yes, it's because there's a debt element. Yes, there is the US reserve, the dollar reserve currency status. Yes, all of those things. But the fact is that the reason that it has trade deficits with a lot of other places is because it has the purchasing power. And those places that are selling into it don't have purchasing power. Right. The reason that America was an export economy in the 19th century is because at that point, the purchasing power was there was greater powers in the world that had purchasing power. Where is the purchasing power going to come from to buy American stuff? So unless you're making the autarkic argument wherein America just becomes completely isolationist and wants to make its own stuff, I don't see how you're going to, I don't see what trade policy is going to do with anything. You're not going to overturn these facts.
Nobody's advocating that. It would be a false assumption to say that is what full isolation is what's trying to be achieved. It's a strategic realignment around core industries.
So if it's so strategic, why has he used this blanket approach? And why does Trump never say that? Why does he just say, the Germans have been taking us for a ride all this time, and all like.
Well, I think you'll see when we get this stuff. Yeah, I think you'll see when we get into my arguments is if you look at the whole big picture, it is actually quite complex, and it's certainly not the kind of thing that you can stand on a podium and put out to the American audience and expect them to get the whole piece. It is a restructuring. It is macro. It is strategic. But that's not an argument you can make to the American public. So that's why he's gone with, all this stuff about reciprocal and they do it to us and we do it to them and it's not fair. And also, but so, just step over all of that. That's just headlines.
To make it clear, Trump is strategically lying to his supporters and to the American public because he cannot tell them the truth. I just want you to say that.
Well, I tell you, once we go through my arguments, if you can tell me how to boil that down to a series of sound bites that you can put out to the American public as a whole, then you are much greater master of messaging than I could ever be, and probably anyone on Trump's team. So, I mean, is it lying when you simplify and you bluster? I suppose you could call it that.
So like J.D. Vance, it's a messaging problem to sell it to the rubes. I just want to make that clear. All right, let's go through your macroeconomic argument and then and we'll see where it takes us.
Yeah, so I believe my first point was that essentially, look, you've been picking up on the thing about the dollar's exorbitant privilege, that the ability that it can basically send debt abroad and then it can get actual real things in return. I think that's kind of been a big point that you've been making. I wanted to make the argument that that is not immutable. It's not a law of nature. And it is going to end in a period of a small number of decades from here. Now, the dollar doesn't actually die, in my view, from weakness. It doesn't die from, you know, people not using it. In fact, it's entirely the alternative. That if the dollar is going to die, it's from its strength. It's because it's become too strong. It's become too much liquidity is drawn out of the world system, and debt cannot be rolled. And that is the core thing here. But the second point, I mean, if you want to jump in there, by all means. But the US, in my second point, has $10 trillion of COVID-era debt that needs to get rolled over next year. That is a significant amount of debt. Now, that debt is not getting rolled at the current levels. You know, if the cost of refund, and you've got to remember, this debt was initially taken on at rates of about 1% or lower, because it was done during that low rates era and the COVID era. Vast amounts of debt was taken on. Lots of it was done on a five-year timescale. That is then rolling over the course of this year. If the rates are not brought down, then the interest expense for the US is going to swallow everything else. Now, you've got to remember that the US interest expense at this point, because this is one of the points that you raised higher up on your list. You describe the dollar as essentially monopoly money, that it's free money. Well, that's true at the point of creation. It's not at the point of debt servicing. The US is currently spending $1 trillion a year on servicing its debt costs. And if it rolls over this current tranche of $10 trillion debt that it's got to do over the next 10 years, and it moves that rate from sub 1% up to something like 5%, you're looking at an additional $300-$500 billion that gets added to the federal expenses. Now, at that point, Elon Musk might as well not bother doing Doge, because everything that he's worked on is just going to get completely nuked by the interest expense that is being added on. So these are the first two points, that this you cannot look at this without looking at the debt situation, which is an immediate and existential threat to the US government if it doesn't tackle this.
So I guess what I want to get in my head is that, okay, so the US has been able to get away with, okay, what Michael Hutchison describes as super imperialism. I have a video called how US debt is a sign of its power, right? Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things it's been able to do is it's been able to say, well, we're going to buy this thing from you. Let's say it's a phone for $1,000, let's say. You pay $1,000. Now we're going to do a shitload of money printing. And, oh, whoops, the value of a dollar has decreased in real terms. So the 10% interest that the debt that you bought when the dollar was worth this much has actually depreciated in value. So yeah, we can give you the interest back, but oh, whoops, it's worth that much less now. So essentially, it's inflated it away. That's why I'm saying that Americans have basically been getting stuff for free. They've not been getting, quote unquote, ripped off. They've been getting free stuff from the rest of the world. Now, how have the Americans been able to get away with that for as long as they have? When it comes to debt, the ultimate question always is, okay, you and whose army? If I'm in debt to somebody, right? Yep. If I leave it long enough and I don't pay my debt back, still, even now in the modern world, the bank will send the bailiffs round, right? The bailiffs will get involved and physically remove you from that, you know, if I don't pay them. In the history of America, it has gone to war several times over debt repayments. I think it was Liberia off the top of my head. There was some sort of war that was triggered because Liberia wasn't paying its debts. Several wars in history have been started over debt repayments. Famously, the Mustache Man. Do you remember the World War I reparations? He said, no, we're not going to play it.
Yep.
What are you going to do now? You well, and whose army? Right,
I would also
and that led to World War II, right? That led literally one of the factors that led to World War II was Germany welching on its World War I debt repayments. Now, in the American case, okay, let's just pretend it's like, well, it still comes down to you and whose army. And as long as America has the biggest army by some distance and is the impenetrable fortress, blah, 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 what is China going to just like invade and like who? How is anybody going to recover their debts from
that? You just put your finger on the key issue.
Yeah,
I mean that is the issue. It's ultimately this comes down to geopolitical and military considerations. As we just talked about a few moments ago, the U.S. military is dependent, cannot operate without the U.S. Chinese supply chains. You know, that 2018 report highlighted the U.S. military breaks at hundreds of separate points if not supplied by China. And we are literally in the process at this very moment of watching the U.S. lose a war against Russia because Russia can outproduce the U.S. when it comes to the key munitions and stuff like that. So your point about, the U.S. has the dollar and it has this exorbitant privilege. We cannot assume that is going to be persistent forever because that privilege is a function of the U.S. military. And the U.S. military is being undermined because it doesn't have the ability for it to produce its own supply chains in a whole number of key cases. There is one Chinese shipyard that has outputted more commercial ships in 1 year than the U.S. has in the entire period since World War II. Now, yes, it's producing commercial ships at the moment, but that same logic could apply to military ships. The Chinese are building a military which is designed to do one purpose, because they do not go around the world bombing people because they're not having enough bum sex or whatever it is that the U.S. military is up to these days. The U.S. is building the Chinese are building their military for one purpose, and that's to defeat the U.S. They have the advantage on the manufacturing, and the U.S. military is dependent on Chinese supply chains. So you've absolutely put your finger on the absolute heart of this issue. Yes, it is vital that the U.S. does not lose its military significance. And it will lose its military significance if it cannot supply its own military through its manufacturing efforts. And then all of that dollar stuff that you're talking about goes away once the military advantage goes away.
So just to recap what you've said, Americans need to be worse off in the short term in order to ensure that their military can still be supported.
I'm saying that Trump should not care if the cost of Nikes and coffee goes up a bit, if the advantages that he gains from this broader policy is to ensure that the U.S. military is viable, which means that U.S. dominance, or at least a top seat in a emerging multipolar world, is not put at risk. And at the moment, it is at risk.
Carry on. Carry on.
Okay. So we kind
my
of...
My cars are not cheap, by the way, Victoria. They're really bloody expensive. Anyway, carry on.
We kind of leapt onto some of the military points I was going to come to later. But I started off making the point, okay, the US has a huge amount of debt that it needs to roll over in the next 12 months. It's about 10 trillion's worth. And if it rolls it all over at these new higher rates, you might as well not bother with Doge because, you know, rolling it over, moving it from, you know, whatever it was, let's call it 1%. Let's say that goes up to 5%. You're looking at something like $400 billion of extra cost going on the US P&L. They're already spending $1 trillion a year. The last thing they need is to be spending $1.4 trillion because it just wipes out any other methods that the US has. What the US has got to do is to get its... cost of refinancing its debt below its nominal growth rate. Now, why is this important? Because the US is at currently the point where its economy, its GDP, is roughly the same size as its debt pile. So they roughly match at the moment. Now, that's very neat and handy for us for the following calculation. Which one of those two is growing faster? Because if the debt is growing faster than the GDP, the debt eventually swallows everything. They go into a debt spiral. If the GDP is growing faster, then the debt becomes manageable. It's still a significant problem. It's been allowed to get to that point, but at least it becomes manageable. So the US has got to get itself in a position over the course, quite quickly actually, over the course of the next year, where it can refinance that debt at a viable cost. And that's part of what this is doing. Now, why does a readjustment matter here? What's important? Well, the important factor is that the dollar needs to come down. The dollar is too strong. The dollar is a wrecking ball. It's something that the macro people have been talking about for a long time. I mentioned earlier that if the dollar dies, it will be a result of its strength and not its weakness. Now, what do I mean by this? About 50% of global debts are denominated in dollars. So there is a constant perennial need for there to be dollars in the system in order to refinance these debts. The second aspect of that is that if the dollar is strong, and the dollar has been very, very strong over the course of the last few years, it raises the effective refinancing cost of the world's debt. So if they can get the dollar down, and I tend to measure this by looking at the DXY, which is a basket of the dollar against a whole basket of other currencies. If they can get that down, what it does is it eases financial conditions across the rest of the world, allowing them to refinance their debt, allowing global liquidity to increase. You need global liquidity to increase. China especially needs this at the moment, because the Chinese debt cycle is a little bit further ahead. They need to get the dollar down, because otherwise they can't refinance their debt. Once they start to refinance their debt, that unlocks the business cycle for them and unlocks further financial easing for them. Global liquidity starts to raise. That puts the US in a position where they are able to refinance their significant proportions of debts as well. So in the short term, the big thing that they needed, which was a weaker dollar, that has already been achieved at this point. And hopefully that will continue to go down. So I think my third point was something like, China needs a readjustment that will give them a surge in global liquidity. That's what I was talking about there. Feel free if you want to jump in before I move on.
I do have a quick question about all of this. Is that, all of this might make sense if Trump and the US government were the only actors here. But this is there's a very complex global financial system, trading system connected, yeah, which has knock-on consequences to all of this.
Don't assume that they are opposed on that one.
But what I have observed, Dan, is that a lot of other economic blocs, let's just say the EU was one very prominent example, China is another example, are being quite belligerent. They're saying, actually, we're gonna be retaliatory. We're not gonna back down. We're gonna meet you. And there's even talk within Europe. I listen to all these Rory Stewarts and so on. They were all saying, like, at what point do the European nations say, like, actually, fuck America? It's a basket case. China's the safer bet right now. America's going down. China's going up. Let's just side with the Chinese at this point. Leave America do what it wants, basically. If it wants to, like, blow up the entire world's financial system, it can blow itself up, and we will just go in because China currently has a manufacturing capacity, et cetera, et cetera. That's one scenario. Another scenario is, what if the short-term pain that people are talking about is so intense that it actually just leads to a global financial collapse, or just blows up the world economy, which some people have talked about, in which case the devastation may be big enough that all of this stuff we're talking about is moot. Because if the entire global economy blows up, are you gonna do anything? Are you gonna pay for anything?
The thing that I would urge people is don't judge this stuff by the hyperbolic headlines. I understand that there's a lot of posturing going on. I mentioned this earlier that both Trump and Xi are going to do their strongman thing where they take a pop at each other in public. I can tell you absolutely the world around, they all understand that the dollar needs to come down because, as I mentioned, 50% of global debts are denominated in dollars. The Chinese, they need the dollar down. The US, they need the dollar strength down. So don't get caught up in, you know, what they're saying and the spin that the headlines are putting on it. They are all aligned when it comes to this aspect of driving down the DXY. So I don't think anything that I've said in the first 3 points is particularly significant. I'm just making the point that this is a prime goal. We know it's a prime goal because Scott Bessent has been talking about this for years. And the entire macro community has been talking about the dollar wrecking ball for years. Scott Bessent was he was a global macro hedge fund manager. He actually originally worked for George Soros. In fact, it was pretty much his idea to do the ERM trade that got the Black Wednesday trade, or the Liberation Day, was the original Liberation Day trade. That was actually Scott Bessent's idea, and he took it to his boss George Soros. And the contribution that George Soros made is that when he asked Scott, you know, how much do you want to do on this, he said 100% of the fund, and Soros said, why not 300% of the fund? Now, yes, I know that Soros, bit of a diversion here, I know Soros is, a literal demon these days, but him and his team are bloody good when it comes to the finance. They are, you know, absolute macro killers on that stuff. So Scott knows what he's talking about. Him and the rest of the macro community has been talking about getting this dollar down for a long time. Now they're doing it. The world is aligned. Don't get caught up on the fact that there's a lot of posturing in public.
So to be clear, Dan, it's all about China, but China's also on board with all of this.
So there are different aspects of this. So the first part that I'm talking about is the need to get the dollar down. That is a significant part of what this is trying to achieve. Because look, what monetary tools have you got? You've got interest rates, and that's basically all Western economies have been using throughout the last 20 years. Oh, we're just going to lower interest rates one more time, or maybe we've raised them a bit here. You know, they've basically got one lever, and they pull it up and down, normally down. Are you going to get yourself out of your current situation by lowering interest rates? Well, no, you can't, because inflation is, you know, a hair's breadth from coming back, and probably will if you lower inflation. Can you raise interest rates? Well, no, because the debt costs are already unviable. So you've got one lever and it doesn't work. You need a second mechanism. And this is what this is providing. It's a second mechanism. So is everybody aligned on the need to get a lower dollar? Yes. And that is part of what this policy addresses. So on this aspect, there isn't going to be any pushback because people are happy with it. And this policy has already achieved a very fundamental and very important aspect of what it was trying to achieve. After that, I then need to come on to the manufacturing and the strategic side of things.
I just want to mention very quickly, people saying that von der Leyen has backed down and so on. That's not really what I'm seeing. I mean, the EU are basically setting up talks with China like nobody's business there, and unveiling investment packages. She's called for a negotiated resolution with China in the face of US tariffs. Europe does not want to get off Chinese imports, according to her. The EU is going to seek help from Beijing. So what I'm saying is that there are signs that the globalists are saying, like, actually, like, sod America, we're gonna actually partner with the Chinese to protect our economies. You know, if they're in debt, yeah, or whatever, so be it. If the world is changing, we have to go with the winners. Basically, it's going to be China. So what do you say to all of that?
Yeah. The EU in particular has a really difficult problem, because they can do what you're suggesting and go down the Chinese route, but then they're effectively just going to become Chinese vassals. If they follow the US, and I suspect ultimately actually they will, they're then trapped in a race to the bottom, because let's say the US agrees a 0% tariff deal. So the only reason that the EU functions at the moment is it's a customs barrier. So it's basically a block of countries with a big wall around the outside with a tariff applied on it. That's what the EU effectively is. And it allows people within the EU to maintain a level of productive inefficiency that they otherwise wouldn't. Now, that you might want to throw that back to me as to say, okay, well, that's a weakness of the US system. If you want to do that, then I'll come back on why I'm less concerned about it. Ultimately, my answer is going to be because of strategic particular supply chains which you want to onshore. But okay, the EU is faced with the problems. If they end up doing a 0% trade deal with the US, well, the US is just going to eat their lunch, because the EU has got itself into a position where it is fundamentally uncompetitive, not just because of the US reason, which is the high, you know, wage cost, which you pointed to earlier. I'm not that concerned about that because you can mitigate that through automation. But they're also incredibly inefficient because they've had this cosseted arrangement around themselves for a while. But the more fundamental reason is they're extremely overregulated. You know, the EU is basically a bunch of regulating bureaucrats rather than, you know, leaders. You know, they're not leaders. They're not strong men. They're regulators. So if they enter into a deal with the US, then there is going to have to be a race to the bottom of deregulation and competitiveness, which the EU is fundamentally ill-suited to doing. But as you say, the alternative is going to China, but then they're going to essentially get vassalized by, like everyone else has.
I mean, the total manufacturing output of the EU of combined is $6 trillion. The total manufacturing output of America is $2.5 trillion. So it's a bigger manufacturing base than America. So on what basis would America necessarily outcompete Europe in manufacturers?
Cost of energy would probably be the big one. You know, Germany used to be an economy that was, you know, 5 trillion euros in size based off 50 billion of cheap Russian energy. And they've decided to cut themselves off at that.
Well, they didn't decide. America blew up Nord Stream. But I'm saying, if there's a decoupling of EU and US, and they go in with BRICS or whatever, they'll just say, well, all of that stuff which was imposed on us by the Americans, which was not advantageous from a European point of view, we'll just get much cheaper energy from our new buddies in China and Russia and so on. And lo and behold, we don't have that energy problem anymore. And we're a bigger manufacturing base than America. So, you know, and now it's us versus you. Let's see who can do it.
You know? Yeah. If I was running the EU, that's the first thing I'd do is I'd make good with Russia and I'd get those taps reopened. But we've just watched the pantomime over the course of the last few weeks of them basically saying that they're going to conscript all the young men of Europe and send them off to die in a Ukrainian abattoir. Get drone bombed from Russia. So if they are capable of making that pivot, then yes, potentially they've got a leg to stand on.
It would require a decoupling from America as the hegemon.
Yeah, and let's take those chances. How likely is that to actually happen?
It's a lot more likely if there's a global collapse due to the actions of Trump than it was if he hadn't have done this, basically. Or if he said, look, this is about China, so I'm going to levy tariffs on these strategic goods, these strategic items, to stick one to China. But he hasn't done that. He's antagonized all of his allies all day, every day, whether it's Denmark or Canada. And he's basically said, no, it's America. It's us against the world. It's us Americans and you Europeans. You, not only are you Europoors, but somehow you've been screwing us over as well. That's what he's been saying. So, okay. You know, so I'm just saying there's a consequence to the Punch and Judy show and the rhetoric. Okay, it could be fake. It could be for the rubes or whatever. But there are actual consequences to it because Europeans now are thinking, hold on a second, are we better off with them or are we better off with these guys over here? Because these guys over here, not only do they trade with us all the time, but they don't like randomly attack us and randomly send JD Vance to give us moral lectures every 2 minutes. They'll be like, maybe the Chinese are better to do business with. The Americans are unpredictable. You know, one minute they're blowing up Nord Stream, the next minute there's this nonsense. It's not a serious country anymore. You understand what I'm saying, right?
Yeah, anyway, I get it. Maybe that is the route they go down. Sorry, what was your original point that I was about to respond to?
Well, my original point was, what if the short-term pain is so significant that it just melts everything down? So these long-term plans won't even be possible because Trump has gone too fast, too quickly.
Okay, so yeah, I mean, in the question, how do you get this? So again, I'm going to have to come back to the point that the US situation...
people saying cope, 6 trillion manufacturing output is bigger than 2.5 manufacturing output, whichever way you look at it. And that is because whichever way you slice it, Europe has maintained manufacturing capacity. I mean, the Germans have been busily like wrecking it over the past couple of years, but they still have a lot of factories. And it's not just Germany. It's like all of Eastern Europe and Czech Republic and North Italy is an industrial base as well. And France has factories too. Anyway,
absolutely. Let's see how much they hold on to it if they continue on their policy direction of ever higher energy costs, which basically is the route they're going down at the moment. I agree with you. Pivot to Russia. Open up the taps with them. That would be a great thing. I just don't see that happening at the moment. Now, on your other point of if we accept my argument that the current dollar privilege is not going to be maintained indefinitely because the dollar was too strong, the dollar was suffocating the system with its strength, and people were running out of dollars, they couldn't refinance their debt. There was going to be a situation, and global macro people were talking about it increasingly, where at some point the dollar was going to be too strong, too dominant, too suffocating, that it would force everybody else to go out and find an alternative for it. Not because they necessarily wanted to, because they were forced to, because they were always dollar starved and they were always trying to refinance this debt. So a great amount has been achieved through this. Now, if we're coming to the broader reorganization thing, and effectively what we're going to need is new Bretton Woods at some point. We're going to need that reasonably soon. Again, this is something that Scott Bessent has picked up on a whole number of times. If you go and watch his interviews, every interview that he gives, at some point he will make the detour to say, I think we're going to need some sort of new global accords and I'm ready to negotiate them. Every interview, he always manages to get that in because that is the view that they are going to be going towards. Now, the point that you're making to me is how do you get to that? Do you do it by being all palliative? What you essentially put to me is, why don't you just go after China and then say to everybody else, we're going to have a new global accords come along to it? Okay, that is a tactic. And that is a tactic that Trump did not choose to use. Well, the tactic that Trump decided to use was, let's tariff everybody. Let's create a maximum short-term pressure point. Let's get this at the top of everybody's agenda. And almost certainly what will follow from this is a whole series of opt-outs and exemptions or readjustments to various countries and a commitment to come on board for a global new global accords, whatever they call it, a new Bretton Woods, something like that is going to emerge out of this. Now, it is purely a question of tactics as to whether you feel the convivial approach or the Trump maximum pressure approach is the best way to get to that. Trump being Trump has clearly chosen the Trump way of doing it. And possibly you're right, the other way would have been better to get there. I don't know, but Trump's Trump, so he's going to take his style.
So it's a gambit to try to maintain American hegemony, which may or may not work, is what you're saying.
Kind of, in a way, it's a recognition that U.S. Hegemony was not going to last. In fact, let me move on to my sort of military side and my strategic points, and I'll explain better why.
Can I ask one question before you get onto that? Because as we were talking, I would notice a lot of comments in the chat and so on. I guess number one question would be, why is it bad for the EU to have protective trade barriers? Why is it bad for the EU to have that, but good for America to have that from the European point of view?
Yeah, so that was the pushback that I actually recommended during that. So, I mean, again, it's a bit like deficits. It's not necessary. It's not fundamentally good or bad in all cases. The issue is that it can make you lazy. In fact, there's a number of cases of laziness here. The biggest case of laziness is actually the thing that we started talking about right at the beginning of the dollar privilege, of the fact that the dollar can send, so the US can send debt abroad and get real things in exchange. That basically gives you a huge amount of cover to get very lazy on your government side and let spending get out of control. And that is an issue. Although from the sounds of it, if you had the dollar privilege, I mean, that would be awesome. You should be using that to fund genuine things, you know, building bridges and semiconductor factories and all the rest of it, things that added value to yourself. That isn't actually what happened. The US basically used that privilege to overconsume and actually consume at the expense of everything else, growing their service sector and pushing all their manufacturing abroad. Returning to the point about the EU, why is it bad when they... Well, it's not fundamentally bad. It's not necessarily always bad. But typically what has happened is they have got lazy and inefficient around a whole number of sectors because they've got this captive internal market. Now, I am advocating this for the US. Why am I advocating it for the US if I'm saying it's bad for the EU? Because what I think the US should do, and I think what they are likely to do, is to basically use it fundamentally as a tool for areas of strategic importance where they are being significantly underpriced at the moment by China, and that's why they're losing those things. So the reason that China is dominating, say, pharmaceuticals and those military supply lines is because they have extremely low cost of labor, effectively slave labor. Is if the US is going to compete on these, that slave labor cost needs to be put at a point where it's not as fundamentally as appealing as it was before, and the US needs to automate in the rest of it. So when you apply it to those strategic sectors that you absolutely must have back, even if they end up being slightly inefficient and lazy because they've got tariffs around them, fine, if you've got to that point, but at least you've got them back in your country at that point, and you're not reliant on China, who can then turn off your supply of heart medication, diabetes medication, or bloody tank shells, whatever it is. Shall I move on?
Yeah, please do.
Okay, so debt refi cycle, talk about that, why that's important. Strategic supply chains, another key point. This was cited in the executive order that Trump did with the tariffs, that US share of global manufacturing, I believe, fell from 28.4% in maybe 2005, I forget the number now, down to 17.4%. So it's lost 11 basis points over the course of little more than a decade. And as I mentioned before, we are literally watching the US lose a war against Russia because of its inability to produce munitions. That manufacturing issue needs to be taken care of in these strategic points. Now, I won't go too much further on that because we basically covered it in the lead up to this in response to other things. And then finally, my key point that I make is that the US is not a superpower because of the dollar. So I think you had alluded to in some tweets that, you know, they're threatening the dollar system. No, the dollar system is under threat anyway, because it was too strong, it was too suffocating, and it was forcing people to find alternatives. And the US wants to be leading that process rather than having people pushed out into something else from a strong dollar. The other aspect is the military power. And again, I talked earlier about the fact that their military fails at dozens of different points because of this. So I've made these final two points already in the lead up to this. The final thing I think I mentioned on my list was that you have to judge this by the ability of the US to remain hegemonic, or at least a top-tier competitor in a multipolar world. That's how you judge this. Against the backdrop that the dollar privilege and its unipolar status was always going to go away. So don't judge it against the last 20 years. Judge it against what the next 20 years would have been in the absence of this policy. Don't judge it by whether the price of coffee and Nikes go up, because that is not strategically important. The other thing is strategically important. Actually, a final thing that I'll throw in on that is this is not something that Trump alone is seeing. Joe Biden saw this problem as well, and his solution was to throw vast amounts of subsidies around. Now, I think that the tariff approach is a fundamentally better one to get your strategically important industries back on shore than basically just throwing subsidies everywhere, which is the Democrat solution.
Well, what Biden did is he had this massive infrastructure bill, but unfortunately, being Joe Biden and being America, which is basically almost banana level Republican corruption at this point, the infrastructure bill didn't actually build tons of infrastructure or factories and the things that it should have done. It was just pork. It was just pork barrel nonsense funding. You know, Biden funding his mates rather than...
Which then drives up the cost of government and then does not address the points that I started with, is that the US is in a debt crisis and it is going to go into a debt spiral if it doesn't address its spending side. In order to get down its spending side, a key element that is going to be DOGE is one, but the interest expense is another fundamental thing. So when you put together the core elements, the strategic realignment with the debt refinancing, tariffs serves both of those mechanisms. So therefore, I think that it is a good policy. And I think what people are going to have to come to appreciate that this is a policy and it is not politics. Yes, there will be some politicking around the negotiation of things that are not strategic and are not germane to the issue that it's trying to solve. But this is fundamentally a realignment.
So my question is, Dan, how, using the mechanism of trade policy alone, how is the American government, without resorting to essentially Mussolini-like directed economy tactics, going to make American companies, Nike as an example, open up factories in America and sweatshops in America?
Yep.
And how is it going to move? How is it going to do all of that stuff?
Well, it doesn't matter, because that's not the primary consideration. The consideration are going to be things like, you know, heart medications and munitions, and semiconductors. Well, those are the key things that they're going for. The Nikes, it's neither here nor there. I mean, that is a problem for the president of Vietnam or the president of Nike.
But it will also be the problem. I mean, I'm sorry about this, right? You can't just say, oh, the price of, like, let's pretend Jamal, who gets a vote, believe it or not, Jamal in Detroit gets a vote, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
When he noticed the price of his favorite sneakers doubles or triples, or they're just not available anymore, and the Democrat says, oh, well, that's the Trump tariffs that have done that. Oh, this is the Trump economy that's done that. Oh, you can't afford, can't afford to eat anymore. You can't afford your favorite sneakers, and you can't even afford a Netflix subscription anymore. How is the American system, because that will become a problem for quote-unquote the American president if millions of people are suddenly disgruntled when they weren't disgruntled before, because you fundamentally messed with the bread and the circuses, which is historically, if you want to get out your Joseph Tainter or, you know, decline of empire stuff, when you mess with the bread and circuses, that's when you actually get political turmoil in a country. So how is America going to manage that problem? I don't buy this thing that consumer goods are just like neither here nor there. They may be from the point of view of
the American state or the security state. I do get you were saying.
Right. But they are a political reality, because when people talk about, quote unquote, the economy, they talk about the price of things that they notice. Those are the sorts of things people will notice. And the upshot could well be that there's a blue wave in the midterms and President Gavin Newsom. Right. And you're banking on the fact that President Gavin Newsom is going to continue the road that Trump is going down and not respond to domestic discontent with the standard of living fundamentally being affected in the short term. Right. This is a problem.
Yeah, but again, we're slipping back into the assumption that everything would have remained as if nothing was done. You know, vast amounts of debt was taken on over COVID, and that debt is coming due now. Now, it would be very nice if, you know, it were to just go away, but that is not the reality of the situation we're in. Huge amounts of debt was taken on at virtually 0% rates, or quite often less than 1% rates, and that debt is coming up over the course of the next 12 months, and the bill for COVID has to be paid now. So how are you going to tackle that? So if all of this of saying, costs are going to be passed on to consumers. Costs were always going to be passed on to consumers. COVID was not free. The 2008 financial crisis, a couple of iterations before that, was not free. All of these incredibly bad policy decisions that have been made over the year, the bill is coming due for that. So
sorry to interrupt. What's happened realistically, politically is that Trump has given carte blanche to the Democrats and to leftists around the world and to people like Rory Stewart to say, and they have just some justification for this, Trump wrecked your standard of living, and he lied doing it as well. He told you barefaced lies because he promised a golden age, and in fact, he's doubled the cost of your sneakers. Vote for Gavin Newsom and never let these populists in power again. So what do you do against that political reality?
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of doubtful that we really are looking at, you know, doubling or tripling the price of sneakers or trainers or whatever. You know, like I said, the economic.
So where are they going to get made?
I would imagine for something like the Nike stuff, Nike's just simply aren't that important to me compared to the bigger relevant stuff that we're talking about.
But important to Jamal, and Jamal gets a vote.
They are important to Jamal. Jamal does get the opportunity every 18 months or so to get as many free Nikes as he wants, because they every so often go through a set of headlines that basically allow undocumented shopping. But that aside, the economics books will tell you that the cost of a tariff will generally be split 4% for the producer, 4% through currency adjustments, and 2% ends up on the underlying consumer. So let's look at the case of Nike's coming in from Vietnam, whatever it was, like a 70% tariff. So if 2% out of every 10 put it on 70%, so there's an extra 14% on the cost of Jamal's trainers to him.
So to be clear, the Nike trainers are still being made at Vietnam.
Well, I don't know what Nike is going to do. I would imagine.
What I'm saying is it hasn't addressed the trade imbalance. They're still being made in a sweatshop in Vietnam.
Well, I don't think that Trump is primarily concerned with Nikes. I think he's concerned with a whole set of strategic issues around US power. But nevertheless, addressing the Nike point, a price increase on Nikes going up 14% is not impossible. But actually, when you look at more recent studies that have been done on the cost of tariffs, actually more of it tends to be absorbed by the producer where they're originating from. So yes, somewhere between 14% and a lower number than that might land on Jamal.
How are the costs absorbed by the producer when tariffs are applied in the country of sale, not in the country
because
of
you because the whoever is importing it says I'm going to import less stuff from you unless you lower your unit cost to me.
Right.
So the tariff still gets paid, but you know you just renegotiate, and that typically does tend to be what happens. It does tend to get. Source.
You're actually increasing reliance on Vietnam then?
No, because the marginal US producer, it may not be for Nikes, it may be for something else, but the marginal US producer is now more viable than he would have been on something else. Nikes are probably a bad example for this, but
it's
a cigar humidifier things, you know, whatever you know the things. I can imagine that's the sort of thing. There's a whole bunch of US producers who are producing those, competing with cheaply put together Chinese or Vietnamese alternatives. In this case, you can see that the US one is more likely to get produced. And again, we're talking at the level of consumer goods. None of the points that I've made have relied on consumer goods. It has relied on the fact that the bill has come due for past political nonsense, 2008 and COVID being the big ones, and that there was always going to be a reduction in living standards when the cost came due, and that this debt needs to be rolled over.
Now, as Trump saves the deep state, the system can then blame Trump for those decrease in living standards.
Yeah, quite possibly. But I mean, you know, my pushback on all of this stuff is, given that there's $10 trillion of debt to roll over and you cannot do it at 5%, not without putting it all on the Federal Reserve balance sheet, and you can't use the mechanism of interest rates that you've used before because you're boxed in on one side of the cost of debt and you're boxed in on the lower side by inflationary pressures. And you've got to do a strategic realignment where you bring your critical supply chains back to the US out of China, and you want to have a renegotiation because the dollar strength is getting to a point where you can see the dollar dying from its own strength because it suffocates everything else. So you need a Bretton Woods 2.0. You need to get everybody around a table. What tool does all of those, if not tariffs? Because fine, you can criticize tariffs, and you can certainly criticize the way that Trump did it as a sledgehammer as opposed to a seduction. You know, we're gonna hit China, but the rest of you we're gonna seduce into doing this new global deal. And maybe they go for that, maybe they don't. But he chose to use the sledgehammer because he is going to force them. It's forced it to the top of everybody's agenda, and then he can have a negotiation. He's in negotiations with 70 different countries at the moment. The EU are modifying their stance. China's going to come on board because they need a stronger yuan relative to the dollar because of their vast debt situation. If not tariffs, what mechanism would you have used to achieve all of these things? And what you certainly cannot do is just assume that the way things were for the last 20 years, we're just going to continue in the absence of this, because, as I say, the bill has come due for COVID and the other policy mistakes.
So if you're right, Dan, do you now expect the upshot of all of this is that Trump is going to end up dropping or coming to deals with all of these different places in terms of consumer goods, and the upshot is only going to be protections around these couple of strategic kind of ring fence items that are going to protect the military? Is that what you expect to happen? Or
so he is looking to hit a number of things. He does like the idea of tariffs. He always has liked the idea of tariffs, and he likes the idea of bringing manufacturing home. So no, I don't expect these to disappear. So let's give some, you know, case points. So let's pick up Madagascar again.
So it is about knives as well as about this. I mean, just to be clear, it is about the consumer goods as well as about the strategic.
Well, it's about
otherwise you would have answered that question straightforwardly and said,
I expect him
to come to deals with all these things that don't matter. You know, coffee, Nikes, iPhones, whatever. The only things that matter are pharmaceuticals and a couple of other things.
So yes, I do expect that to happen, with the caveat that I do not expect it to be a broad free trade system across the world. So something like Madagascar, who produces vanilla, that's never going to take place in the US. I can well see deals being done with Madagascar that bring that down, but that's going to be a relatively input, but it will probably happen. Same thing will probably happen with a whole bunch of coffee producing nations. Do I expect China and its immediate sphere of influence to ever go back to the level that it was before? No, definitely not on China, for the reasons that we talked about. It is a geopolitical rival, and you have to get strategic industries out of there, but you also can't lower it on the strategic sphere around China, because otherwise China will just do what they did with the Nikes. Of just, okay, fine, we're just going to move the factories from South China straight into Vietnam, and we just basically ship it through there. There'll be no difference. So that whole sphere is going to maintain a higher level. And then something like the European Union, well, they're big boys themselves, and they're going to have to choose, as we talked about earlier, are they going to become Chinese vassals? Are they going to stand on their own feet? The only way that they can do that and be competitive is with a very low cost of energy, which basically means they have to become best mates with Russia. Maybe they can do that, but their current rhetoric and the rhetoric for the last 3 years tells me that that is not likely to be a thing. And therefore, I suspect that in the end, after making a lot of noise, and actually, you read Tony Blair's book, didn't you?
Yes.
What did he say about whenever China is the EU is given a choice between China and America? He said they will always pick America in the end. There might be some squawking, but they will always go with America in the end. And that is what I think is going to happen here as well. The EU's problem is that they are going to have this race to the bottom, because if they enter into a zero tariff arrangement with the US, which J.D. Vance has talked about, they are so hamstrung by regulation that they're really going to struggle in that. And then you've got the wider Anglosphere outside of that. I think that we will probably do well. We're fairly close to them. You know, we're starting out with a 10% tariff. I know that New Zealand and Australia are higher up on that. They have separate geopolitical considerations that we don't really have time to get into now, that basically both of those are well advanced, especially Australia, are well advanced to becoming Chinese vassals at this point. That is another issue that Trump has got to turn his attention to later on. Anywhere else that you want to pick up on? I mean, South America, that is probably one of the better examples of somewhere between those two poles. I expect somewhat higher tariffs to be the result of this, and a whole bunch of deals to be done. But again, some of those have been creeping into China's sphere of influence as well. So that's why I'm not giving you a simple answer, because it really depends on what you're trying to achieve with each of these.
But to be clear, as per your analysis, Trump doesn't really care about a US-Madagascan trade imbalance, ultimately. So let's say when all said and done, it's still Madagascar sells a certain amount of tons of vanilla to America and basically doesn't buy anything American because they can't afford anything. So that on paper, that still looks like a massive trade imbalance. He doesn't really care about that. The rhetoric about balancing trade with all other nations is just like hot air, according to you. Is that right?
Well, I can't go so far as to say it is hot air, because he does genuinely want to return manufacturing to the US. I'm just saying that for me, Madagascar is a good example for one where the rate is probably higher than you would have started at if you weren't doing the sledgehammer approach of maximum negotiation strength that he has picked. So I wouldn't be surprised if that one came down. Maybe everyone just ends up paying more for the bloody vanilla.
How are any of these? I mean, I guess I come back to how are any of these places going to get their trade imbalance to parity with America? Because that involves basically Madagascar, Vietnam, any of these places buying as much American stuff as they export. But they can't do that because they don't have the money.
Yeah, I mean, going from memory, Madagascar's biggest imports are chemicals and machinery. I suspect not all of those chemicals and machinery are coming from the US. Some of them are probably coming from China. So they could do a deal where they say, look, we want to sell you lots of vanilla. You want to buy lots of vanilla. We've currently got some piffling sum, which is huge for us, but small for you, buying Chinese chemicals and manufacturing, and every so often we buy an aeroplane or something. We're going to redirect these contracts to you. Also, if you ever want to station a ship off our coast, then fine, you can do that, and then a deal is done there. Maybe that's how it works out. But my whole case is you've got to look at this from the big geopolitical macro finance macro strategy view, geopolitics view, defense view. That's where I'm looking at it. So I'm quite happy to go down into these micro cases of what's going to happen with Madagascar or El Salvador or whatever it is. But I'm just fundamentally less interested in that, because I just think that is not the driving focus here, and it shouldn't be our driving focus either.
But they could. The reason I'm drilling down into these specific examples is to make them more concrete. Is that what if they just say, like, yeah, we're not going to do that. We'll just sell our vanilla somewhere else and we'll get the Chinese in because they can be trusted. Because they are like tons of countries could just decide to do that at this pivotal moment, couldn't they?
Well, I mean, the economic answer be there that because there is now presumably less marginal demand for vanilla coming from America, that they will indeed sell some of it elsewhere. And US consumers will decide how much they really, really want vanilla flavored custard as opposed to strawberry flavored custard, and whether they're willing to pay a very slight premium. But you've got to remember, by going from raw goods produced in a country like that to the actual finished good of your bowl of vanilla flavored custard, I mean, I expect it to be a very small increase. The raw input goods at one side are not going to be a significant factor on the rest of it. You know, a far more significant factor on the cost of your vanilla custard is going to be energy prices in the US. You're shipping the bloody stuff around the country.
You're assuming the supply chain remains intact. The supply chain could break up.
Why would the supply chain break up? I mean, it's now just got a higher cost.
Because what was viable 10 minutes ago is no longer viable because he's stuck an 80% tariff on it.
Yeah, but we're talking about the supply of, cheap agricultural goods. You know, seriously, a bigger factor for some of these things is going to be the global price of diesel, but for moving it around than it is for a bloody pot of vanilla. So it's not going to break supply chains. It's just going to increase the cost. And when you factor into the end product that you buy on a shelf, a dessert in some fancy cafe in America that has a bit of vanilla in it, the amount of it that was the original input cost of the raw vanilla is going to be very small. So, in that case, I don't think the supply chain is going to break. It's just going to raise cost a bit on it.
So in the final analysis, it hasn't ended globalism. It's just made it more expensive.
A little bit of nuance around this. So has it ended globalism as in has it ended global trade? Absolutely not. No, that will continue. Has it changed the mindset from we are going to focus on line go up, the cheapest possible consumer prices, and if that means exporting every last bit of our manufacturing to China because they've got the lowest labor cost in order to do that, if that's what you mean by globalism, then yes, that has ended.
But the, I mean, Jeffrey Sachs's basic point at the end of that clip I played was that let's just pretend the rest of the world doesn't do that. The places that maintain the cheap labor model will just be more competitive than America. They'll just be more competitive. And eventually, if that ebbs away at American power in the long run, you end up with, what did F.A. Hayek say? The chocolate pickle factory in America that nobody wants to buy the chocolate pickle.
So let me tell you why he's right and why it's a stupid thing to do. So let's do it by economics 101. You go to a university, you get taught the comparative advantage, the whole stick, that you get more of something. If you just trade with people who for whom it is their comparative advantage, they do better and you do better. And you both maximize your overall position. The line goes up the most. Brilliant. So let's do that. Let's focus on line go up and get our unit cost down as low as possible and maximize total GDP. Brilliant. Jeffrey Sachs is right. You're doing better. Okay, now a war starts between you and China. And you suddenly realize that your military is unable to operate now that all of a sudden the base layer of your military supply chains has been taken out. Okay, so you've spent 19 years being richer, and in the 20th year, when you go to war with China, they just win. So yes, he's right, but so what? If you don't have that strategic resilience,
right?
So what?
Your argument is based on security. Trump has been saying he's going to bring jobs and industrialization back to America.
It's part of it.
And what Jeffrey Sachs is saying, what I'm saying is, if you end up building that factory in America and it is uncompetitive, it's just like a loss enterprise, which is good if you're making bombs, I guess, right, for security. But if you're making anything else, all you've succeeded in doing is making chocolate pickle factories. This is the basic like Keynesian issue from back in the 1930s or whatever.
Yeah, okay, so that is a good point. So let's address things, which is, so Trump also wants to address the broader point of bringing manufacturing back, and let's consider things that are neither luxuries like Madagascan vanilla pods or strategic essentials such as munitions and parts for your F-34, whatever, the plane things. Your cigar humidor or something, getting that brought back. A lot of people have been sharing that clip that went around on Twitter of Ronald Reagan explaining why tariffs don't work and why it makes you poor and so on. The thing that you have to bear in mind is if that was from an age when the key competitors to the US were countries like France, Germany, England, Spain, countries like that, people who were producing stuff basically to a pretty high standard. Something that lasts. If there are any boomers in the audience, at least some of you are going to be running a dishwasher or a washing machine that's like 30 years old or three trees or something, 30 years. You try buying a product today that lasts like that. What we've got today is we've got basically very cheap Chinese tat built to last for the minimum possible time period built by slave labor. Now, in terms of being competitive, you're never going to be competitive in terms of your unit cost of labor. China is always, Vietnam, they're always going to win at that. But where America can compete is with a bit of automation. Now, there should be things that come with this policy. So there should also be, and actually this is going to be my biggest criticism of the tariff policy, is it would have been nice to have an industrial strategy put alongside it where you attack deregulation and also maybe you can make some tax changes. So I don't know, 100% depreciation on your capital investments in your US relocated industrial plant, 100% tax depreciation in year one, things like that. There's a whole bunch of things that could have been done. But what you will increasingly see is that the marginal producer, so for, I don't know, maybe the US and China are so far apart when it comes to curtain poles that it's still going to be cheaper just to pay the tariff and get Chinese curtain poles delivered. But something where the US is at least approximately close, now they've got that extra lift in order to get them back into the game.
But, I mean, all of your talk has been basically moving into a scenario where you're going into an almost quasi-war economy with China. Sounds like gearing up for war with China. But you're still assuming they're going to sell us curtain poles.
Well, I'm assuming, so in my scenario where, in the 20th year we go to war with them, for 19 years they sell you curtain poles, and in the 20th year you have to make do without curtain poles. And if you have to make do in the 20th year without curtain poles, I mean, you're probably going to be okay. If in the 20th year you have to go without munitions and part of your F-35 and heart medicine and diabetes medication, well, in the 20th year you've got a really big problem. So, fine, let them sell us curtain poles. And if we ever get cut off, then I guess we just have to deal with it as best we can.
So I mean, I just want to drill in, because all of your analysis has been based on essentially saving like the military industrial complex and American kind of security state, I guess I'd call it, right?
It's been a core part, but not the entire thing. Yeah.
Whereas a lot of the talk I see on MAGA media has been on consumer goods, and it has been on things like, I mean, I watched this one thing. It wasn't Laura Ingraham, but it was like some like Newsmax. You know, all the conservative American women are blonde. Like, you know, that it was like one of those. And she was saying, Japan has been screwing us over for so long, she was saying. For example, Japan has a 700% tariff on rice. On rice. Can you believe it? Japanese not buying American rice. They need to lower that so we can sell rice to Japan. I mean, I looked into that. Japan consumes 98% of its own rice. And America is the number one importer of rice into Japan. 0.98% of Japanese rice is American. And this conservative woman thought this was an outrage and wants Japan to buy more rice, right? Are you saying that all of those exchanges that have been happening up and down your timeline are fundamentally just smokescreen and a waste of time?
I wouldn't accuse the individuals making it, and that they understand it at that level. We started out with this I said, look, when we get to my points and I build up my argument, and my argument is a multi-part thing. It's the strategic layer, it's the military layer, it's the debt refinancing, it's the bill come due, it's the need for a new global system to come together. That we've reached that point. And I did say, look, if you could summarize that argument in a way that you can get across in a 30-second soundbite, brilliant. And that is not what's being sold. And I have pieced this together by, I mean, more than anything, basically just following Scott Bessent for a long time.
It's the easiest thing to do in the world. China bad, America good, USA, USA, USA. It's the easiest argument in the world. So why not?
Well, not really, because he's gone for that sledgehammer approach of hitting everybody with tabs at the same time, because he's also trying to get
Japan to buy American rice.
No, what he's trying to get is a new trade deal. There's going to have to be some reordering of the global system. That is going to happen sooner or later, because the dollar is not going to remain the primary and only system.
Throughout this conversation, I've tried to pin you down on what that's going to look like, and you've rejected the idea of Nike opening sweatshops up in America. And you've rejected the idea of Japan buying more California rice or whatever. So what's it going to look like? I mean,
these things aren't binary. It doesn't have to, it's not, US is not moving to a system of self-sufficiency. You know, on Nikes, I suspect they're just going to pay the tariff on them because it's still going to be cheaper with slave labor. Or maybe, I don't know, maybe Nike discovers that they can put in some machinery into a factory in Kentucky, and they can automate the process. And with some deregulation, some tax advantage that will come through, plus the comparative cost now against the tariffs, it becomes viable to automate this and do it in Kentucky. I don't know, but my broader point is I don't really care, because that for me is not what is driving this. I don't think that Trump is doing all of this in order to reshore Nike production. I think it's for the reasons that I outlined. So
what's the point of saying all the other stuff just to give talking heads on Newsmax something to talk about?
Well, I'm not responsible for what they talk about. So, I mean, they can frame this however they like. You know, more than one thing is being hit here.
I see. Okay. Well, I mean, all I'm saying is that if all that other stuff is simply just noise, smoke and mirrors, Punch and Judy as per usual, then it doesn't come consequence free, right? Because the actual reaction to this around the world, both within America, outside of America, in the markets and so on, has been to say, no, this is actually like a fundamental change in the structure of production. So, you know, it doesn't come cost free.
No, there were loads of costs associated with this. I mean, there's going to be a whole bunch of people who had a supply chain that included a whole bunch of Asian countries that are now going to be, you know, have unviable businesses. So I mean, let's talk about businesses that I have sympathy for.
But then it's going to be Donald Trump. I voted for him, and now I've lost my job. I was a fool to believe him. Gavin Newsom, bring back America like we made it. Ronald Reagan, blah blah blah. You know,
if that's what's going to happen. If that's what decides your vote, then you know what can you do? I mean, it's and on the point of the hysteria around, on the point about the hysteria around Donald Trump, you've got to remember that, you know, once he upended a box of fish food into a lake while he was stood next to Abby, and you know, the world went hysterical about that. I mean, the world is going to get hysterical about whatever it is that Trump does, and he needs to hit the points, the strategic, the currency.
I'm not talking about the world. I'm talking about the bloke who lost his business due to these actions, who's going to correctly blame Donald Trump for it, but go with the other side, who may have other ideas.
Well, what's your alternative, though? I mean, you need an alternative to all the points on my list. If not tariffs, how would you have done it? And how would you have messaged it better?
So, I mean, you're basically assuming, though, that the US deep state wants to do this to save the military, right? Trump is just a front for that.
No, basically, that's not my argument.
Basically, what you're saying, though, isn't it?
No, it's not, though. No.
So Donald Trump has unilaterally decided to try to save, you know, the vestiges of the American empire, on behalf of the deep state, or the deep state's on board with this. It's either going to be one or the other, right?
No, I don't think you can simplify it to that. Why can't you simplify it to that? Because it's wrong when you simplify it to that level. It loses so much resolution that, you know, it's no longer functional. Donald Trump has wanted tariffs for 30 or 40 years. He did some in his first term. They were significantly smaller than this, and they actually basically worked. He wanted more this time round. Now, what he probably would have found is that if he was the only supporter of it, then it would have been like, okay, Grandpa, you know, you can do a bit of tariffs, and they would have applied it to some small element. What we've seen is that the rest of his team has enthusiastically got on board because they recognize that they can achieve what they want to achieve. So Scott Bessent has got on board because he understands that he can use this to achieve his goals, which he's been talking about for years, of a lower dollar and a need to restructure the global financial system, which is why he keeps bringing that up in every interview. So he's got on board for that reason. Trump was already on board because he just likes the name of them, or whatever it is, whatever reason it is that he's writing for 30 years, that's the case. Scott Bessent comes on board for that. And then the military guys come on board because they look at it and they realize that their military supply chains are dependent on Russia. So they come on board for it as well. So once you've got all of these elements together, that's why they're doing it. And this is why it's multi-pronged, because it's trying to achieve different things. Trump wants to hit it because of the manufacturing aspect. Besant wants to hit it because he wants to get the dollar down and he wants a global reordering. He wants a Bretton Woods 2.0. The military guys, they want it because of the strategic supply chain stuff. Now, you have to understand that there are three elements that are all driving this. And you can't say, okay, well, there's inconsistencies between one or the other, and therefore it does not hang together. No, there are inconsistencies because there are three different motivations, and they have come aligned around a policy that can achieve enough of what they want, and they can cohabit together. That's the disjoint that you're seeing.
But from what I hear from you, it's going to achieve some of what Besant wants, and it's going to achieve some of what the US deep state may want from the military point of view. Mm-hmm. But it's not going to achieve what Trump wants, which is the manufacturing bit. At no point did you, throughout this, yeah. Have you addressed that?
Well, no, I have. I said I expect...
Go on.
Well, I'll address it now. So I expect some of it to be rolled back on, but then I don't actually know. You know, we will find out over the coming months to what extent it is rolled back on. You know, Madagascar, I expect that to be rolled, because I just don't see why you wouldn't. EU, I think they will probably want to drive towards a zero tariff rate, because actually that's better for the US, because they will end up eating them if you lower that outer EU trade war, because the EU is so regulated up to the tits on, you know, everything that it basically can't move at this point. So it's not as simple as anything. But yeah, of those three legs of the stool, monetary, military, and industrial, my current assumption is that the monetary and the military are more likely to get more of the things that they want because they have to, because it's not optional, and that the manufacturing side will probably get less of what it wants. But I don't know, maybe Trump really holds the line and he does force those countries to address the trade deficit, and he does force companies to move back. Now, there is a delay at the moment because a lot of companies are looking at this and saying, okay, well, I don't know to what extent these tariffs are going to hold up over time. If I'm going to relocate a factory from Cambodia or wherever, Indonesia, to the US, well, if I take that decision today, it's 5 years before anything rolls off the production line, because there's a whole, I mean, the permitting process is going to take 18 months alone, which is why I say deregulation should be a part of this as a broader industrial strategy. But it's going to take 5 years to get to that point. And what I don't want to do is commit hundreds of billions to this new factory if in 2 years' time, or maybe even say 5 years' time, when Trump is out of office, the whole thing unwinds and these tariffs are no longer a thing. So the worst element is that level of uncertainty that everybody expects him to roll back on it. He's saying, I'm not going to roll back on it. I'm hinting that I think he's going to partially roll back on some of it, but I don't know. But maybe he sticks to it. But whatever it is, it would be great to find out what the long-run position is, so that everybody can make the right decisions. But in any case, there is going to be a lag on that industrial side because of those reasons. I think everybody's going to get something that they want, and there will be manufacturing wins. I just don't expect it to be anywhere near what you've been talking about, which is complete all turkey.
What you're going to do in 2 weeks' time, when Trump signs a pile of new free trade deals with all these people and all your favorite slop merchants who were talking about economic nationalism this week, will be running around saying, see, I told you, art of the deal. It's the art of the deal. Now we've got the freest, fairest trade deal of all time. And basically you're back to where you were a month ago. Just put globalism back together. I mean, what are you going to do in 2 weeks' time when that is almost certainly going to happen?
So I mean, to be clear, are you suggesting what I've been saying, which is there will be a whole bunch of targeted deals for the less strategically important stuff? Or are you expecting him to rescind them entirely across the board?
Well, I'm just expecting him to hold up a deal saying, look, Vietnam dropped its tariffs. We drop our tariffs. Now we've finally got a free and fair trade deal, blah, 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 blah. And that's it. You see what I'm saying, right? Now, rather than it actually being economic protectionism, which is what people have been talking about for the past week, it's actually freer trade than what you had before.
Well, I've never advanced the argument that it's about economic protectionism, so I just don't have a dog in that fight as to you know whether they say that or not.
I see.
Yeah, but no, I mean, my whole analysis with this is I think there will be a whole bunch of deals that get done in the meantime. But I don't know, maybe he holds the line.
But when those deals are done, the existing supply chain just carries on existing and nothing changes.
And well, manufacturing, that's what,
manufacturing does not go back to America or create extra jobs or any of the other things that were promised. So
yeah, but I am responding to your hypothetical of if that were to happen, that is not what I'm expecting. I expect there to be some.
You expect them to hold the line and for this tariff regime to exist for the next 4 years.
Nope. What I'm saying is I think there will be some targeted role. I mean, this is what I've been saying the whole way through. I expect there will be some deals, and it will vary depending on the region and the considerations they got for that area. So I do expect that the Asian region, the area immediately surrounding China, is going to end up in a different end position to the EU, for example, is going to end up in a different position to Madagascar or South America. So I think there are going to be differences. My base case is that there is some rolling back of these and deals. It's going to be exactly what you said. It's going to be, there's been a deal done with Guatemala or Madagascar or something, and we're lowering the tariffs on this, or there's a deal done with the EU that's we're going to lower the tariffs on this. And there might even be an amelioration on the Vietnam in the immediate US orbit, but I don't expect that area to go back anywhere close to where it started. So it is going to change, and there are going to be tariffs. I just don't know if they're necessarily going to hold at this current level or where they're going to moderate a bit in the middle. But it's not binding. It's not either.
But according to you, the ultimate upshot has to be whatever happens, America makes its own pharmaceuticals and its own semiconductors or superconductors or whatever. Those are the things that matter. Everything else is up for grabs. Everything else is neither here nor there.
I wouldn't go so far as to say everything else is neither here nor there, because like I say, it's those three legs of the stool, and the manufacturing aspect of it is important to Trump. But yeah, absolutely. I would be shocked if the
namely end result... the reason people voted for him, by the way. But anyway, carry on.
Yeah, but it's,
people didn't vote for him to, you know, save the deep state. They said they voted for him because he promised to bring back manufacturing.
Well, I don't think the ability to produce your own military supply chains and your own heart medication is doing the bidding of the deep state. I think that is doing what's best for the American people. So I would reject that framing,
literally in the interest of the US security state. I mean, that is who would ultimately care about these concerns.
I mean, they're
US security state.
Yeah, they will care about it as well. But I don't see a divergence there between your average American and
what I'm saying is that people weren't thinking about that. They were thinking about manufacturers bringing back jobs and manufacturing.
Yeah,
Trump has not been thinking about that since 1980.
But I sense you're trying to move me into one of two poles. One of which is there is going to be complete autarky on one side, complete economic isolation, and all the manufacturing is going to return to the US, or it's going to end up in a complete free state. And I'm rejecting either of those, and there isn't a conflict between either of those.
What you haven't given me is any mechanism for manufacturing to return to America, because the fundamentals I outlined at the start haven't changed. And all you've said is, yes, it will cost more, but it's worth it for security. Well, that addresses semiconductors. What? It addresses, pharmaceuticals and masks or whatever. It does not address all those other goods that... millions of goods that make up the economy.
So I believe I have addressed that point. I think I very much have addressed that point. I'm saying on some goods, and maybe trainers is an example, it will in the course of things, it will be cheaper just to pay the tariff because you're reliant on slave labor in Vietnam to do that. I don't know whether that is the case for trainers, but maybe let's assume that it is the case. But for cigar humidors, the marginal cost of a US-made one versus a Chinese-made one has shifted in the favour of the US one. And so that market is now predominantly going to be done in the US as opposed to China. So I just can't give you an either-or position. Either it's going to be all free trade or it's going to be all US-made. I expect there to be a shift towards US manufacturing as a result of this, but that I'm not going to give you a guarantee that that means that everything is produced in the US. It is going to be a mix. So we are going to end up in the middle of those two extremes, but we're just going to move a bit closer to US manufacturing everything rather than US manufacturing everything and complete free trade, if that makes sense.
I see. Well, it's interesting times. Let's see what happens. We'll know one day, eh? My sense is that if things get too painful in the short term, it will just do Trump in and they'll blame everything on him and we'll end up with Democrats.
What's the metric of painful, though? Because I know the boomers are really upset because their 401k have gone down. But that's setting up an interesting narrative where basically the more the boomers scream about their 401k being down, the more it emboldens the younger voters.
Not just anything anybody cares about, especially people who aren't into politics. Anything they care about in their lives, if they see it get significantly more expensive or it's not available anymore, there's just a very easy narrative. Oh, it was Trump what done it. He promised us the moon on a stick and he gave us nothing. And now I've lost my job and my business on top of it. Whoopee-doo.
Think about what
they won't be able to, they won't get their heads around anything else other than Trump did this. Now I want the Democrats in.
Yeah, have the American people or Western people in general over the 5 years seen any inflation? Yeah, significant, huge inflation. So you're telling me that they were perfectly fine with the rampant, double digit, 18-20% inflation that they got in 2020, 2021, 2022. It's ameliorated a bit now, but
Why they voted for Trump in the first place.
Okay, and now they're going to get selective 13-14% inflation
if it ends up being that. You're assuming it's that. It could be much worse. It could be an entire industries are blown up.
I mean, yeah, it could be, but I mean, the reason I came up with 14% is because I took the worst case scenario of applying 20 basis points out of every 100, which is what the economic books say that you should look for, although recent studies have suggested it's actually less than that, of that ends up on the consumer. And then I took Nikes from Vietnam and I took their 70% rate and I took 2 points out of every 10, got to my 14, stuck that on with a pair of Nikes, and that's my worst case scenario. For something else like vanilla pods, the raw good input is going to be such a tiny aspect of your vanilla custard that I don't think it matters. So I think actually, yeah, 14% is reasonably toppy for what they're going to see. Well, unless of course companies just decide, because it is a great excuse just to do whatever you want with prices and then blame Trump. So there'll be an element of that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons I'm dubious is that we've been down these kind of roads before. Like, I mean, we mentioned everybody's sending the clip around about Ronald Reagan championing free trade. Reagan famously put massive tariffs on Japanese cars. I mean, I remember when I was watching pro wrestling in the 1980s, a lot of the heels were Japanese because there was Japan was big bad at that time. But did those tariffs work? People still buy tons of Japanese cars in America. It didn't fundamentally do the thing. It didn't
They're
still selling Japanese cars.
Yeah, I mean, I'd have to look into it. I mean, I remember looking at this ages ago, but yeah, those tariffs did work. They did get a realignment deal and more US electric. I'd have to look into the details, but my abiding impression, and I'll follow up maybe in a tweet or in a Brokenomics or something, I'll look at how they did, but my remembrance is that actually no, they did work fairly well. No, they did not result in no manufacturing being done in Japan and it all being done in China, but that's not the metric to judge thing. The metric to judge thing is on the where it was at the time and where it was trending to. Did it end up arriving in a different place to where it was trending to, and did it where it arrive at be more preferable than where it was trending to?
But it didn't fundamentally overturn the trade deficit, which is the bottom line thing that Trump has predicated his entire reputation on. He has made this about trade deficit. Yeah.
Yeah, but you can't make these things binary. You can't make it about.
But it is binary. If you stand up in front of the entire world as the U.S. president, say, here's a chart of all these things. These countries have been treating us really badly, and the problem is we've got a trade deficit with them. If you then put in a bunch of measures and do not overturn the trade deficit, the trade imbalance, to a trade surplus, then loads of people are going to say, look, it didn't work. That's just the real fact. People will do that. And they are doing it.
Well, I mean,
in huge numbers.
People say all sorts of things. But I mean, you can't judge this on does it achieve 100% of the best case scenario? And if it gets to 98%, then it's a failure. I mean, if it gets you 1% closer to where you're trying to achieve, it's some kind of a success, whether you bother crowing about it or not. But I mean, AA, when you get ill, do you have a lemsip when you catch the flu? Because it's not going to make you better. It is going to make you slightly better.
I'm just saying is, realistically, if it doesn't produce the result Trump promised, people will rightly say, it didn't do what you said, Donald. I've lost my job. My mate lost my job. His mate lost his job. You didn't bring back jobs. You didn't bring back manufacturing. And, you didn't bring down the prices.
So you didn't
overturn the trade deficit. So
what you're talking about, I don't think the average American is going to be talking about the trade deficit as a whole. I think if they wouldn't have if it hadn't been
put in front of their face, but it's at the front page of every single newspaper in the entire world.
So the average person is going to be talking about the trade deficit.
The opposition are going to be like,
the liberal media will
you said this and you didn't do it.
The liberal media will throw whatever line they can in order to dunk on Trump, and his friendly media will support him on this. When it comes to the broader messaging of how does he get this across to people, there will be a whole bunch of factories that relocate. Some of them have already started to do it, relocate from abroad to US. So whatever happens from here, he will be able to go around two factories saying, look, this factory exists because of me. These workers, they love me. They think Trump's great. I'm the greatest. Look at this factory, blah, 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 blah. You'll be able to create a narrative around this. So I'm not concerned about his ability to the message.
I see. Okay. All right. But he couldn't sell the message of, actually, this is all about China.
No, because for him it's not. So as we talked about,
right,
three legs to the stool. The finance people want it for their reasons, and I broke down what that was. The military people want it for their reasons, they broke down what it was. And the Trump, the originator of all of this, he wants it for the manufacturing reasons. And this is a coalition that's come together, and they're all getting something of what they want.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well,
so that's why Trump is leading on the messaging of about it's all about manufacturing. If you listen to Scott Bessent, he's leading on this is all about a global restructuring and getting over dollar strength. And if you listen to Pete Hegseth, he's talking about the military aspects of it. You know, they're all talking about what matters to them, and they are a coalition in this. So when you say, you know, why isn't Trump representing Scott or Pete's view? Well, because he's got his own view for this, but it's a coalition that has built this policy.
Well, if you write down, everything's going to be hunky-dory. And if you get our visas in, apply for a factory job over in America. If I'm right, unfortunately, it's going to be pain and misery for everybody. And on top of it, you're going to have to put up with the copes of everybody else when it doesn't work. But let's see. Let's see what happens.
A slight misrepresentation, because what I've been saying throughout is that the cost of COVID and other policy misadventures has come due. So pain was coming anyway. Through what mechanism do you suffer the least pain possible? But it is still starting from the position that massive past bills are now up for being paid. So I'm not saying everything's going to be hunky-dory. I'm saying that this is the best solution out of a bad set of options.
But you have to try to sell what is effectively a downgrade and a loss for the American people as a win. Is that what you're saying?
Well, the loss was coming anyway because the bill has come due. And like I say, I'm not desperately concerned about Trump's ability to message because I think he's quite good at that.
So it's a type of managed decline in a way. I mean, I'm just trying to strip away any BS around this and see it for what it is. US empire is going down. It's up shit creek. There needs to be a way to reorientate so it doesn't go fully tits up. You need to try to sell this. So, you know, come up with this tariff thing and blame the rest of the world. It's basically what's happening there.
Again,
Call a spade a spade, Dan.
I feel that is stripping resolution out of this picture to the point where I'm now looking at it and saying, I can't really tell what that is. I mean, I wouldn't reduce the resolution. Well,
no. Let's just be straight second. America massively overspent, and now it's blaming the rest of the world as a cope. And it has to be framed as a win because America can't take a loss ever.
Fine, I'll go with you on that one, then.
Yeah, okay. All right, good. Okay, well, at least we can agree on some things. There are some super chats and things, Dan. Do you want to stay for them, or do you have to go?
Well, if they're super chats for this episode,
they are. They're for this. Yeah.
I won't stay for the super thanks because I think that'll be old episodes and stuff.
I'll probably do those another time because we've gone a bit long. Studio Rayner says, Dan, what the hell was your idea about who should govern us? Do you plan to become a politician?
Right, so the issue here is that it's the difference between is and ought. What I was doing in that segment was saying what I think will happen, because it is a repetition of the pattern that has always happened before whenever there's been a change of governance structure. So I was not advocating what I want to happen. I was advocating what I think will happen, using the logic that's applied before, as I laid out in the segment.
Eyes That Watch says, tell Dan if he wants to be taken seriously, you need to tie.
Ties are for waiters.
I'm an advocate of the Tony Blair no tie.
Yeah.
You know, Tony Blair was the first politician to stop wearing.
Yeah, Carl keeps doing this thing where he berates me on the podcast for not having a tie. But he puts it on like 10 seconds before we're about to go on air, and then he takes it off immediately after. So...
He's not an authentic tie wearer.
No, it's a bit.
You're a man like, of the people, like Tone.
It's a bit like during COVID, where you could see them. They put on the mask just before they went on stage. So I'm not doing that, and I'm not wearing a tie either.
Studio Rayner says, "I think the slop is to talk about economics when it's clearly a geopolitical move or pure stupidity. Probably stupidity.
Maybe."
Tom says, "Dan, what are the odds that you see for the tariffs raising inflation, leading to the Fed actually raising rates, even with over $9 trillion of debt maturing this year?"
Number of things there. I mean, the Fed currently has a rather unfriendly chairman in Jerome Powell. I mean, he'll be gone before long. I expect the Fed will raise rates, but there are a number of... I talked about the legs of the stool of the tariff policy. There's a number of legs to the stool of financial conditions. The dollar is something we very much talked about. Oil prices, which we didn't talk about, and rates. And actually, the dollar's been coming down. You're seeing some downward pressure on oil. Rates is the third leg of that stool, and that is lagging the other two. And actually, it's probably going to lag financial conditions and liquidity, which are turning up at the moment. So, yes, I do expect rates to come down, but it will be a little bit later. You know, it will lag to some extent.
Sorry, I'm laughing as I'm just looked at the chat for the first time, and people are saying things like AA wears his bicycle safety helmet 24/7, thinking I'm making shitlib arguments and so on, but I'm not. I'm just just pure economics.
You have arrived in a weird position where, you know, it's basically you and Ben Shapiro and boomers. I mean, everybody that you hate is suddenly on. It's like that meme with the rope. You know the one I'm talking about? The tug of war?
Yes. No, I mean, it's not just all those people. There were many other people who were saying these things too. Many other people from across the political spectrum, left and right, are saying what I'm saying. Because let's just say what Trump has done is... Would you agree, Dan, it's a high-risk gambit, what he's done? And it may not pay off. It's a pun.
With the caveat that doing nothing is even more high-risk. Yes, I will agree. And the thing that I will agree in particular is that his approach, because he, and we talked about this earlier, he could either do a targeted thing on China and then reach out to everybody else and says, please come and have a renegotiation of the global system. Please do it. You know, we put on some really good sandwiches and then hope that people turn up. And he decided to use a sledgehammer approach of whack this to the top of everybody's agenda so that they have to confront it to give himself maximum negotiation position. So, yeah, the way that he's done it is the bigger risk. And, yes, doing it is a risk, but doing nothing is a bigger risk because of the threats I outlined.
Is it going to lead to World War III? We didn't talk about that. I know it's outside of scope, but it puts us on a... If this is very similar to the trajectory that led us to two world wars.
So the fundamental question here is what do you think makes World War III more likely? The US and China both being able to win it, and it's a question mark, or China definitely being able to win it because they can just turn off the US military by turning off the supply chain? You know, do you think China would be benevolent in a position of absolute dominance if it found itself in that?
Well, I mean, the fundamental thing that led to the two world wars, if you strip away all the ideology and all the rest of it, is that Germany was threatening British power, basically,
okay,
in the world at that time. And also America saw a chance to, you know, bolster its position, which it did. But fundamentally, there was a new threat, right? And that is unacceptable to any power, right? The prospect of a threat. This is what do they call it? Offensive realism, according to Mearsheimer. Yeah. This is what great powers do. And China could actually not be aggressive, right? China could take no aggressive actions. And the threat that America perceives causes America to essentially like burn it all down so that it can be lord of the ashes as opposed to China or whatever, which is awesome. What some people are arguing this, like that Richard Wolff I watched, he was claiming this, for example, and Jeffrey Sachs actually later on goes on to talk about, in fact, John Maynard Keynes, where he talked about Keynes made his name in 1919 when he was part of the negotiation team for the Treaty of Versailles after World War One, and he said, what we've done here is going to make another World War inevitable. And it did. How you manage the peace,
well,
right, then leads to war. And
I'll just straight up tell you that I don't know the answer, but do you want to take a view on, let's say this wasn't done, and that 20 years from now, China had built up a significant military that was capable of defeating the US, and the US military was dependent on Chinese supply chains. What do you think would happen in that scenario? Would the Chinese be benevolent, or would they take advantage of their position of power?
Oh, without doubt, they'd go for it. They'd absolutely go for it. I agree with that. I mean, you're basically in, Nash equilibrium type logic then, you know. But a lot of geopolitics does come down to things like that. It's tricky. It's tricky. The thing I would have liked America to have done from its own point of view is, rather than go for this, is to have spent the past 10 years reindustrializing. It's almost like they put the cart before the horse here.
Yeah, right. But how? I mean, Biden tried to do it by subsidies. Trump's doing it through tariffs. If you reject both of those mechanisms, you have to come up with another one.
Well, I mean, in the 1920s and 30s, the fascists essentially did it by basically forcing companies to do stuff.
Yeah, I think tariffs are a better option than command and control economies, but. That is another option.
Chris O'Hanlon says, what is your response to Gary Economics?
I've done a segment on it. Basically, there is he basically says that wealth inequality is both the cause and the symptom, and it's the measure and it's the metric. Whereas actually wealth inequality is at the end of a whole chain of economic drivers that get you to that point. And so he's starting his analysis long after the process has begun, and therefore his analysis will be wrong because he's not seeing the big picture.
Okay. Emmanuel Peter says, what if the elite failing to stop Trump let him loose? Like post-Brexit Boris wave, punished populists. Give voters what they want hard to teach them.
I guess what he's driving at is this bad policy because it's too much of what they want and they go too far kind of thing? What's his key point there?
Yeah, I think just that. See, he wanted this and it's gone tits up. So, you know, come back to the reservation and stop voting for these fuckwits, basically.
Yeah, possibly. No, the Boris wave was something fundamentally different, wasn't it? It was flooding our country with millions of people who shouldn't be here. Whereas this, pushed, if there's no let up on the manufacturing aspect of the three legs of the stool, then it will mean that if you're a high earner, you have to pay more for your flat screens. And if you're at the bottom of the pile, you might get a job in a factory.
Eyes That Watch 69 says, tell Dan. Oh, no, we did that one, didn't we? Coney says Starmer has just come out doubling down on net zero. Apparently he wants to, quote, win the net zero race. Oh, Jesus. I mean, see, this is the thing. Yeah. If the European leaders and Starmer were serious, they'd scrap that overnight. I don't know why they don't. Coney says, are these tariffs designed to fail? Also, thoughts on Thomas Sowell's recent quote on these tariffs.
I don't know what Sowell's recent quote is. He must be like 98 by now, but if he's still putting out
quotes. Apparently he went on the Hoover Institute. I haven't seen that yet.
I haven't seen that one either.
Legendary economist says Trump's tariffs could replay devastating history. He says that the broad tariffs risks causing an economic downturn, says Sowell. And in fact, he did the uncommon knowledge. Bloody hell, how old is Thomas Sowell now? I'll have to watch that just to see what he's looking like at the minute.
Basically fossilized, yeah. But I mean, Thomas Sowell is brilliant, but he is still, an old-fashioned libertarian. And, you know, I've got some common cause with libertarians, but, you know, be careful. Don't smoke too much of it.
Femboy Fantasia says, so I laugh every time I hear that name. Couldn't most of Dan's concerns be dealt with by focusing on China? We can deal with European fake friends more delicately. We did talk about that, didn't we, yeah, Dan?
Fair enough.
It's not the approach he's taken, is Dan's answer. Frenjamin Church says, the worthless dollars we export for foreign goods is what makes domestic goods unaffordable. $500,000 houses and $12 sandwiches.
Yep. Yeah, I agree, because the mechanism is that you're gonna print money. You're gonna print money through the commissioning of debt that you send abroad that redenominates the value of each of those dollars. So yeah, you can have as many streaming services and bits of cheap plastic tat as you want, but you can't have anything of which there is a genuine limitation in supply, such as houses. So, yeah, agree entirely with that one.
Alex Amont says, I wonder why empires deindustrialize in the first place. The later British emphasis on shipping and finance over manufacture, for example, or the Rust Belt being screwed in favor of China, seems like short-term thinking. The trouble is, and I've talked about this before, is that economic policy is always a function of power politics, basically. I mean, we talked about this before, Dan. There's an arc, right? Early in the empire, it's a high tariff mercantile thing. Both British Empire and American Empire follow this path. Then when you're at a certain size, free trade itself becomes a control mechanism because the soft power control mechanism is being part of the free trade network. I did a whole video on this recently. But
well,
then,
you covered it on your Brokenomics with me.
Yeah, the Brokenomics I did with you, and then I did a subsequent video where I looked at, I think it's called something like why the tariffs show the US empire is in decline. And then when on the downward swing, they're like, shit, things are going badly. we need to start trying to patch things up, or we need to remember the things that made us great, or, you know, and then, you know, you start then having a high tariff environment, which is what the British Empire did late on, you know, in the 20th century, basically. And then it was only a short time before the British Empire was no more.
So I can well see one of your books being written in 30 years' time that, you know, says something like Trump brought in a tariff policy, but it was really all about setting up for the coming conflict with China. And it was sold as, you know, this other thing, you know, I think is a bit more nuanced close to that. But I can see that through the frame of which you look at things and the books you quote often cite, that's how this will be portrayed in future. It's just a function of the geopolitics behind it.
Yeah, but I mean, you could also write a book saying, well, yeah, the thing is that the British brought in a high tariff environment because they had to compete with the Germans, ultimately gearing up for World War II, et cetera, you know. And it's, well, this
wouldn't,
is like,
be a bad analogy.
The parallels are scarily similar, only the scales are so much bigger now, and nuclear weapons and so on, which means that the prospect of America and China being at war, I think, is simply like too great for most people to even contemplate at the minute. So,
well, it would be unfortunate, but I don't think the Americans are going to allow themselves to get into the, or continue to allow themselves to be in a position where it's simply unwinnable for them.
Our friend Jermyn Church says America has a glut of low-skill workers not employed in the high-skill factories who would benefit from those jobs. Carlyle approves. Yeah, I mean, I will say the one bit where I disagreed with, where Sachs got a bit boomery, I guess you'd say, is that his de facto assumption is Americans simply do not want those sweatshop floor type jobs, or they don't want to work in a warehouse, or they don't want to, you know, they don't want to do those low skilled jobs, and that's why they've been outsourced. I mean, again, it's a different conversation, but my arguments for those things would not be economic. I wouldn't sell that as a better standard of living. I'd say, well, you know, gives you more of a sense of well-being to, you know.
Well, I mean, there are a certain segment of the US population that I don't think the standard of living is the core consideration. I think you want to be turning off food stamps. You want to be turning off welfare. You want to be restricting their supply of corn syrup and DVLA jobs, and they probably should be in a basic factory.
Studio Arena says, okay, so what happens if the US tells China they'll be nuked if they challenge US hegemony? Honestly, it makes more sense than these tariffs, scorched earth. Dan, that's one for you.
So it was you saying, why don't we just threaten to nuke China instead of doing tariffs?
Yeah.
I mean, you could try that. I mean, that's not the approach that Trump has gone for. You could try it. But what he's doing there is he's giving me an alternative, which I've been asking for, but that is an alternative. I still think tariffs are better than that.
Frenderman Church says, I will live in Trumpton and be happy. Utes 4321 says, I mean, I do think this is the MAGA version of you'll own nothing and be happy, personally. But Utes 4321 says,
well, it's more like, you know, you're going to have to pay 14% more for your curtain rails and Nikes, but, you know, your cousin
will get a job. UTIS 4321 says America have been getting beads and shells for their assets. Who is wealthy? The borrower who consumes, or those that own the means of production?
Okay. So let me address this point, right? Okay. So yes, US was creating funny money, sending it to China. And US Chinese peasants were producing stuff, selling it to Americans, earning dollars that way through that cycle. But then what were the Chinese doing? The Chinese were basically sending that money back to the US and buying up the NASDAQ 100 with it. And the big industrial advantage that the US still maintains, even though it's lost its manufacturing output, is its innovation layer. And that innovation is largely captured in the NASDAQ, especially the NASDAQ 100, I mean, perhaps even more so in the Mag 7, but certainly in the NASDAQ 100 as a whole. And the Chinese have basically just been recycling this cash into buying up the NASDAQ. So you're in the situation where you're basically funding consumerism through printed money in a process that ends up with the Chinese owning your most innovative companies. I mean, it is the current situation. That's why I keep saying, don't judge this policy against the current situation. and think, okay, well, there's going to be a little bit of extra cost in this and that. We're going to upset people. Judge it against the situation that the US was walking down. And, you know, that is another aspect along with the military aspect that they've already talked about.
Studio Arena says, my stance remains the same. The managerial elite on both sides benefit from the status quo. Nothing will happen. Russia could react because they are less managerial than China and America.
Well, if Trump wanted to benefit the managerial class, he would have just keep funding this through Fugazi money until we get to the point where China can win.
Atlas Code says, one, people don't import people for GDP line go up, but don't impose tariffs because GDP line go down. Reduced immigration is a tariff on labor.
I suppose you could look at it like that, yeah.
Femboy Fantasia says, the EU has always worked hard to keep the US out and to displace it for China. Trump is accelerating that. Ukraine did Nord Stream.
I take the Tony Blair line and I expect EU to ultimately align with America, but you know, maybe they're surprises. Maybe they will become Chinese vassals in the end.
Atlas Code says AA took an L when he said that his father's factory at the higher end of the production line was subsequently purchased by China. I typically glaze over AAA over Don. Well, I mean, they didn't buy the factory. The Chinese bought the parts, came and disassembled them and took them back to China. That's what happened.
Same difference, though, isn't it? I mean, really.
Yeah, well. But I mean, the point is that factory was no longer a goer for whatever reason. Hunger was.
We didn't have Trump tariffs.
Hunger says the whole. I mean, do you think the Trump tariffs would have saved that factory? I wonder. Hunger says this whole debate can be solved by which economic strategy is healthier for a random nation in a paradox game. Dan's here is a right and sound strategy for any game. Studio Rainer says, I don't like Dan because he doesn't admit that the core issue is that the US sucks. The US should have just let the British run stuff. Depopulation. Okay.
I feel a great and deep sense of pity for anybody who doesn't like me. I mean, you really are shutting yourself off from the light.
He also says, Dan, you realize the entire immigration solution was due to the US. AA is a British man, and Dan is an American apologist. Depopulation is the crisis.
I agree depopulation is a problem, but I mean, it goes to the over-financialization and the Fugazi money aspect that we've been talking about. So this moves us closer to something where people are going to more likely to have a job and a home earlier in life and start a family.
Okay, I've noticed you've snuck in jobs coming back there. During the debate, you never once explained how those factories are going to come back. But I'll let it go. Atlas Code says, okay. Tariffs split the labor class from the yuppies. Labor like tariffs, yuppies do not. This is why Biden did not reverse Trump's last tariffs. Studio Rainer says, Russia wins. China, EU, and US managerial states will lead their citizens to depopulate. Look at South Korea. I'd wager China is at a similar point. Germany needs to work with Russia. No to US. No. And then another word that he says. Coney says, thoughts on what a Mar-a-Lago exchange rate accord might look like, possibly with the US forcing vassal countries to peg their currency to the value of the dollar in exchange for low tariffs?
Bloody good question. And I've only really just started to think about that. And I need to give that extra thought. And I do need to come back in a future Brokenomics of what Mar-a-Lago Accords might look like.
Atlas Code says Europe has a 20% VAT. USA has a 0%. A VAT has some effect on consumption. Trump has said that increased tariff, lower income tax. This is a free move.
Be nice, I suppose. We'll have to see how it plays out.
I don't think that, you've got to remember that America imports, was it $2.38 trillion or $3.38 trillion? Whereas I'd imagine that the tax revenues from income tax is significantly more than you'll get on the tariff.
Oh, yeah, is it 10? Is it 10 to 5? We've been talking for
Talking quite a while here. Do you want to go?
Well, no, it's just that I notice everybody, the office lights are getting turned off. And people
It's 10 to 5. We're running late here.
Okay, well, I need to get out of here at 5, otherwise I'm going to be locked in.
Yeah, okay. Studio Rayner says, Scott Bessent was part of the Soros crew, by the way. MAGA is brain rot slop. Broman Henk says, we're 4 months in. There's an eternity to 2028. Coney says, reshoring of American manufacturing will necessitate the eyes of the managerial state, the continuation of the importation of infinity Indians to work in those new factories. Cringe Walker says, Trump's gambit is very risky for global standing, but the benefits for the core is much bigger. This makes Trump seem more like a Justinian figure. Sam153 says, who is going to clean... Go on, Dan, sorry.
No, I was just giving the thumbs up to my producer chap who he's bravely staying... How many super chats?
There's like three, four.
Oh, go ahead then.
Sam153 says, who is going to clean up the broken chairs and tables in the office after this one? Well, thank you very much, Sam153. It means so much. That's a question for Dan, really. I guess it's your producer. He's staying behind.
I don't do any actual work here. I just talk.
The Devastator says, what's your perspective on Australia's future?
They are going to have... America's going to have a talk with them at some point because they've allowed themselves to become too entwined with China.
China. I remember I did a video years ago called Why Does China Produce So Much Steel? It's got a lot of views. And during the course of that, the trade figures with Australia were scary. And that was like 5 years ago. Mm. It's scary. I don't know what China does, Australia does. Or how Australia remains part of the quote-unquote West, given its dependency, because China could destroy Australia overnight, basically. Yeah. Seamus O'Blaine says, Femboy Fantasia is the new Coney current year. Frenchman Church says, people buy Japanese cars in USA because Toyota and Honda manufacture their cars for the US market inside the USA, tens of thousands of jobs. Well, that was one of the consequences of the Reagan tariffs, incidentally. Malcolm Mackay says, if Trump triggers the market correction, does that mean the US could be better positioned to make a V-shaped recovery?
I'm not getting caught up on the fact that stocks have moved, you know, whatever it is, like 11% over the past few days. I mean, I'm a crypto investor. I'm used to 70-80% moves one way or another in a year, so it doesn't faze me in the slightest. On the broader point of markets, I've been saying this about economics for a while. Liquidity is coming through, the business cycle is turning, markets I expect to be significantly high by the end of the year, so all the short-term noise will be forgotten.
I think that is it. I think these ones I've done. I think they're ones I've done. Okay, excellent.
I'm going to take it as done then. Oh, one more. Okay, yeah. One more.
Remember how much farmland the undefined bought in Oz 2? Guessing that's the Chinese. So, yeah, the Chinese have bought farmland in Australia too. Well, thank you very much, Dan. As always, with debates, I declare total and complete victory, blah, 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 but so do you. People who agree with you will declare victory for you. People who agree with me. Declare victory for me. That's how debates always go. But it was certainly interesting. And, you know, kayfabe aside, I do actually think that the most convincing angle is the one that it's all about China. And this is a geopolitical thing that was going to happen regardless of who was the president. That's my kind of...
Is it not possible that the most convincing answer is actually my answer, which in the military is a part of it, but... You know, the Scott Bessent and Trump also have their reasons.
I am inclined to view that all of the Trump reasons are just noise.
He's been talking about it for 40 years.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I think the Trump component of it ultimately won't lead anywhere. But I think the military part that you're talking about, and possibly the monetary part, will happen.
Those are the two that I think that have more staying power in this, because they're necessity rather than campaign. Right. Thank you very much for having me. I got to go before I get locked in. And
excellent, Dan. Yes. And you're going to chop this up and put bits of it on Lotus Eaters as well. So that should be fun.
Exactly that. Yeah, they'll be carefully edited to make me look very clever.
Great. And I'll just remind everyone, promo code Mandy, 25% off all the courses. And I will see you again tomorrow. Bye, everyone.
What goes on in this town is none of your business.
As long as I'm living here, it is.
Then maybe you shouldn't be living here!
Well, that's easily fixed.